kids. It's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I'm your host, Joe. Joining me right now to start off the show, Chris Taylor. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm back.
You are back. How's it going?
Or is this the same episode?
Oh, no, different episode.
It's fine. It's thundering outside, and the thunder sounds a whole lot like a washing machine. But apart from that, everything's going great.
It's a good cover. That is a really good cover.
Yeah, the thunder here sounds like a fan, sorry.
There's a lot of weird-sounding thunder out there, but as you could tell by the other voice on the call, we are joined by two fantastic guests returning to the show, Zach Johnson, Kevin Simmons of Asymmetric. How are you guys doing today?
Very good.
Fantastic.
Awesome. And what kind of thunder does everyone have? We have a fan, we have a washing machine.
Sleeping cat.
Sleeping cat, that's a good one.
Oh, awake cat.
I have an awake cat, too, so there's two awake cat thunders out there, a sleeping cat thunder, a washing machine thunder, and a fan thunder.
And the occasional car.
And a motorcycle. We heard one of those before, too, before the recording started. Oh, man. So how's everyone doing today? How are you guys?
I'm good.
Yeah. We are busy with post-Switch launch activities.
You just released West of Loathing on the Switch, and I noticed you guys were first on last summer, and it was 9 months after you were on that the game came out, and I'm wondering if something funny happened while I was drunk.
Could be. I don't remember when it was that Nintendo first approached us about the port, but it happened relatively quickly after that. There was way more filling out forms, I think, on Kevin's part than there was certainly work on my part and maybe work on everyone's part to get the port done.
They reached out to us actually on when we on launch day.
Oh.
That was the first
time. Never mind, it took forever.
Yeah. We met with Nintendo at headquarters at PAX Prime or PAX West, I guess. And I don't remember when that was.
Like September-ish, usually, right?
Yeah, and then...
I've never been to a PAX, so I have no clue.
There's so many of them.
I can recommend it. In my experience, when you go there, they let you make a Nintendo game.
Well, shit, I should go to PAX then. I can make a Nintendo game.
Someone on Twitter was suggesting that that Nintendo should just hand us the Paper Mario license and let us make a game in that IP.
Oh my god, I was expecting a bombshell here or there, but that is early to drop a bombshell like that. That would be amazing if that ever happened.
Right?
I think the idea of it is pretty fun. I don't know if it would be as much fun as everyone thinks it would be to suddenly pivot to managing a team of that size. And also having Miyamoto himself standing over our shoulder telling us that our jokes are too crude.
Aw, man.
What?
I don't know. I think
he'd
enjoy it.
Yeah, probably. I don't think, though, they've never... I didn't realize this, but those games are all made by a wholly owned subsidiary. I always thought that they were made by a different studio, but it turns out it's like second party.
And when you say holy, do you mean like H-O-L-Y? Like mm-hmm. The Church of Nintendo?
Lord, yep. Reggie smiles down upon them.
Yeah, but it's I weirdly, right before I had a half an hour or so to kill between getting where I am and this call. And so I finally, yesterday, my Amazon-ordered GameCube memory card showed up, which was the last thing that I needed to start replaying the Thousand Year Door. So I played through the part of the prologue of the Thousand Year Door minutes ago.
There is a lot of text in that game.
Yeah, there is. And also, GameCube does not look that great on a new large television.
Well, the key there, you just got to get those component cables that are dime a dozen, you know?
Yeah, I looked into that, and like that does not seem like a thing that would cost $200, but it certainly is a thing that costs $200.
Holy shit, for real?
Yeah.
I couldn't find a cheaper one than that, yeah, so I was not going to do that.
Yeah, there's a story behind that.
Well, now I'm curious. Do you
know
it?
Yeah, I'm really curious,
yeah,
too.
It's that they were never commercially available. Nintendo came out with the GameCube right around the time that HDTVs were starting to become more of a thing. So they were basically like, well, TVs are going to start having these ports. So if you send us a request card or something like that, we'll ship you some. So they were like a mail order only thing for a while.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, huh. So they weren't in stores. That's why they're so rare and expensive.
It seems like it couldn't be that hard to manufacture. I'm surprised somebody hasn't started making them and selling them for $180.
One company did, and they did. So you're exactly right.
Oh, well, good.
Don't they
well,
have one?
Guys, I have an idea. The $160 GameCube component cable company.
That sounds like an E3 announcement. Come out on stage and drop that. We're sure innovating has today.
I found in my box of old GameCube stuff I think it's a like a Monster or Mad Catz S-Video out cable, but my television doesn't have S-Video.
No,
it has. It does have a S-Video. A composite video in, so I'm able to play it, but yeah, I just know it. And I don't even know if S-Video would be any better. It seems like at least it's a digital signal, right?
I mean, even components not that great. There's only like two or three titles that actually even put out in 480p, so you're just getting a slightly better signal.
A slightly better shitty signal.
And maybe I could just set my TV to that mode where it's letterboxed down to like playing Doom on a Tandy.
What you do is just make yourself a custom cable and hook it up to your game.com.
Oh, God. Okay.
I saw some sort of an HDMI adapter, but that was also seemed expensive. And I already, the one thing when I was recently going through all my old video game stuff, the one thing that was conspicuously missing from my box of GameCube stuff was the GameCube. I had all of the controllers and games and cables, but I had to buy a copy of the console itself on Amazon. And then when I got there, it didn't have a memory card, and I sat down to play Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door, and I couldn't. I guess I could have just marathoned the entire thing without saving.
The PlayStation Christmas all over again.
Yep.
Oh, do you also need like memory cards for new PlayStations as well?
Not new ones, but the original PlayStation, like it infamously, that was like the first popular system that needed a memory card for most things. And like that Christmas, there was just like this huge thing of like people complaining about needing memory cards.
It's like not getting batteries when you get a present that needs them and everything is closed on Christmas, so you can't play with your toys.
Yeah, and Sony is bad about like telling people that that's what they needed.
So you should only get your kids toys that are powered by Chinese food, so that way you won't have that problem.
Or Chinese food stores could start selling batteries.
Oh, hey, there you go.
Stores, restaurants, Chinese food restaurants. What the hell am I saying?
And
you know, one of those food stores where you go sit down.
And they also sell PlayStation memory cards.
That'd be smart. Original PS1 memory cards, not PS2, PS1.
No. Yeah.
Or are they going to double dip?
I was happy, though, that the GameCube memory card was not $100. It was $15 for 512 megs of solid-state storage, which is chafes a little bit, but, you know, you need that particular weird plug.
I can't believe that GameCube component cables are $250 on Amazon.
Yeah, and they don't plug into the regular port. There's a special port for them. There's a second port on the back of the GameCube, and that's what it's for. So they didn't even come with audio cables. You had to still use your regular AV cables.
That is so stupid.
It was 2000, what, 3? 2?
If you wait until there's like a thunderstorm outside, though, you can use any port.
It's one way to look at it. So we're 20 minutes in, and I don't think we've said anything about what West of Loathing is. So for the people who don't know what this game is, why is it on GameCube?
It just seemed like a really good fit for the system. You know, it's, its visuals are right out of 2003. Yeah. That's probably overplaying it, actually. I you know, its visuals are unique and timeless. That's the thing about it. West of Loathing is a stick figure comedy cowboy adventure game RPG hybrid. It's been almost a year since it came out, and you'd think that I would have gotten those adjectives in an order that I could come up with without having to stumble over it every time. But
thinking.
It's a game that we made and released in August on Steam, and as we've said, just recently on the Nintendo Switch. And it's a big, sprawling, goofy open world cowboy RPG.
Now, and Chris, it's got
black and white line drawing and stick figure art, which belies a deep complexity to the gameplay. And Chris, you did some kind of a review of it or something, right?
Something like that.
That's about what you call it, yeah. And actually, since the review, I have now completed the game, or I've beaten it, and played through a lot of the after core. So yeah, I talked about it a little bit. Praise the cell shading graphics. Yeah, was a little annoyed that there's no motion controls.
No, yeah, there is HD rumble. And
there is, yeah.
And we replaced the icon because boy, were a lot of people salty about that.
Really?
What is it with people getting so pissy about the icons for Switch games?
I think it's because they're so big, but they're still called icons. So sometimes a developer will say, oh, an icon, I know what that is. But what they actually mean is like an album cover. Yeah. And so, you know, if your album cover is just like a rectangle with the name of your game in Arial, people are really not going to like that.
That was our problem, was because when we were on the development units, like you have to buy special hardware to develop on the Switch, and on those units, the game icon is very small. So we just thought, oh, okay, well, then that's just what we use. It's just the same small icon that we used on the PC. And then only after it was released did we realize, oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of had a point about this, right? It doesn't look like the other icons, you know, because like I said, the other icons look like, you know, they have the complexity of an album cover.
We never
saw it in the right context, and so and we had an asset that was perfect for it, so we just patched it. You know,
there's an exception. The dungeon crawler Heroes of the Monkey Tavern. The icon is just a monkey with a beer in its hand.
Oh, that's all right.
I'd see nothing wrong with that.
Like no text or anything.
Yeah, it works.
And then North also just says North. But it's a $2 game, so
I guess I can kind of see, because when you're on the home screen, it's not like the Wii. I don't actually remember what it looked like on the Wii. It's not like the 3DS or something where it's this big grid of stuff that you can move around. Like every game that you've bought on the Switch is a giant square staring at you for the rest of the time that you own the thing. And so I can see why somebody would object to there being a bad thing on there that they didn't like. So
I finally got to more games than actually fit on that. It only shows the first 12.
Yeah. I have over 100 downloaded, and
God
it eventually,
damn, Chris.
you just hate the whole thing. It's your fault, Joe.
I know it's my fault, but still.
You're the one that gives me them like
yeah, you're
three
the,
times
you're the one that went to 99 PAXs and made 99 Nintendo games.
Yeah.
That'll teach me.
How dare you?
Is there Chris, did you run into a limit? Because I know the Vita had like a bubble limit on there. Was there a game limit on the Switch that you ran into yet?
Haven't hit it yet. It's still every game I've ever played is right there on the menu.
Gotta keep working on it then.
Yeah, it's that first 12 and then it just goes into a grid. And yeah, the very first game I ever played is still right there at the bottom. So
what was that first game?
Cave Story Plus.
Hmm.
That's a good indie title.
It was a real system seller.
Yeah, I sense
the sarcasm there.
Oh no, it wasn't sarcasm. It was just nonsense.
I got it with the system, so yeah, it's the first one I popped in, and I haven't popped it in since. So,
see, because it's a real system seller.
Yeah,
that, and it's been released how many times before?
I mean, I have it on three systems. I have it on two systems, and that was mostly by accident. So
I'm curious to jump back a bit. What was the original icon for the game, and what did you change it to?
The original one was the same as the Steam icon, which was just like a black sheriff badge with WOL written across it. But it looked like it was blown up from a tiny, you know, a 30 by 30 pixel icon for pretty good reason.
Because it was.
And it was just very stark. I mean, it was fine. It wasn't like blurry or messy or anything. It was just stark. And the new one is just like one of our million. I saw there was a tweet that I retweeted yesterday because I thought Kevin would think it was funny. Of a guy saying, I mostly got into game development so that I could make hundreds of different sizes of the same image. So we have a lot of different configurations of the sign that says West of Loathing and the beer and gun guy.
Nice.
Yeah, I've had to add it to so many different storefronts, and they all have their own specific requirements that I just have all the assets separated in a Photoshop file, and I just sort of remix them so that it doesn't get totally stale, I guess.
How many different storefronts are you guys on now?
Currently we're on three, but we're adding a couple new ones in the near future.
Things you can't talk about yet?
Yes.
Is it one thing you can't talk about or two things you can't talk about?
That's an excellent question.
They can't talk about the amount of things they can't talk about.
I mean, we can say we're planning on putting it on Itch, right? Like that's not.
We were in the press release for the Kongregate cartridge platform. I don't know if you've heard about that.
No, I haven't. What's that?
So Kongregate was like a website that hosted a bunch of Flash games for years and years, and they are launching a sort of Steam competitor, I guess, that is got an interesting business model. It is definitely way more friendly for smaller indie games, because like you as a developer get to keep 100% of your profits up to the first, I want to say, $10,000.
Oh, wow.
Which for a lot of the smaller games is a significant chunk of change. And they are launching sometime this summer. We're going to be one of the launch titles on that platform.
That's pretty cool. That's seriously a game that I would invest in a platform for.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be better than game.com.
Nothing's better than the game.com.
I know. I was glad you caught that.
We're also going to launch on the N-Gage app store.
Yes.
Fuck yes.
And that'll the Tiger R Zone.
Oh, God. The Tiger R Zone.
Report it to one of those things that's just like 100 Tetris variants.
I mean, you could absolutely put KOL on a Tiger R Zone. I mean, it just moves one frame at a time.
I want to go to a mall kiosk that has like an N64 controller that hooks up to your TV with like 400 games on it, and West of Loathing is one of them.
It might not run on N64 hardware, actually. Where our requirements are not. Although they're higher than you think. It was weird to learn when we were building this game. Our assets have to be very, very large for modern video hardware to render them in a way that doesn't look like crap, because they're so used to like photorealistic textures that all of the 3D acceleration is designed to like smooth stuff out in a way that just doesn't work at all on our art. So like the buildings in a lot of the, like the towns in West of Loathing are the maximum size that an art asset can be in Unity.
Yeah. It's like 46 by 4096 or something. Like
yeah.
That. So is your game legitimately 4K ready?
I think so.
I don't see why not.
Man, I bet would look awesome on PS4 Pro and Xbox One X.
It looks pretty good on Retina Apple monitors that are big. I mean, because that was like one of the original hardware targets was like, this should run on a normal ass Mac. So
I went to the store and they were selling normal ass Macs there.
Yeah.
What is a non-normal ass Mac?
badass Mac.
I do not recommend ordering the normal ass mac and cheese at the diner next to
at the food store next door.
Yeah, sorry, food store. Yeah, I forgot that.
Oh man, so Chris, I know you poured a ton of time into the game. What kind of questions did you have for these guys? Putting you on the spot.
Let's see. Lots of questions about the vague future. First question, are y'all planning on implementing They Might Be Giants references from after Factory Showroom?
Probably not. I think that's kind of where I fell off in the
just the Electra years.
I don't remember like Kingdom of Loathing is absolutely full of that stuff. I don't remember a ton of it going into West of Loathing. What did you notice specifically?
The reason I said Factory Showroom is I noticed the cultists all worship a spiraling shape.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I'm sure that's mentioned. There's got to be some kind of little lyrics drop in there.
A little bit. I don't think there's any direct references, but I was just like, the spiraling shape makes you feel weird. And I was like, oh, okay. that's about what I thought about it.
Yeah, I guess that is the only reason to refer to a spiral as a spiraling shape.
Yeah, and then there's the flavor text for the matches. I've got a match, your face and a face that's not currently on fire or something like that.
Okay, yeah, good. Yeah.
That's about all I caught.
Although that said, that's just me and They Might Be Giants referencing the same, like, old saw.
True, true. So, but I mean, as an old TMBG fan, that's the way I interpreted it.
No, that was correct.
Sometimes it's the reference to the reference, but you're like, well, I know where they're coming from. I appreciate it, by the way. I was just, like, curious.
Not to, like, go off on a total tangent, but I do wonder how many things that we attribute to Shakespeare are things that he just was referencing in his time, but we've lost the original, so, like, he became a canonical source.
Yeah, like, a lot of the satirists, like, their work actually outlasted the stuff that they were satirizing.
Right.
So I wonder then if in the distant future, like West of Loathing is going to be used as an original text for things that have been otherwise forgotten.
The only surviving Western.
Yeah, exactly.
The holy transcripts of the West of Loathing.
I mean, I would appreciate that because it's one of the few Westerns that's not overtly racist. Because, which, again, appreciate.
Yeah, we talked about that to some extent. It does not make any sense to give stick figures race in the art, right? Because there is not any way to make a black stick figure that does not look like a white stick figure in blackface. Like, there just isn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we kind of just made the decision that, you know what, in our goofy cowboy game, we do not have anything important to add to the discourse about genocide associated with the opening of our great nation. And so we're just not gonna put anything about Native Americans in there. And we were also careful to not like, okay, well, we're not gonna have Native Americans, but we are gonna have goblins. So like none of them are going to wear a feather. We gotta make it's not like it was hard because that's not what goblins are in our sort of worldview anyway, but it was just like, it was a thing that we were careful to avoid. I worried a little bit that we were going to get criticized for sort of whitewashing it, but I guess that because the game is so goofy, just nobody cared. The internet outrage machine just had no reason to target us.
Right. I think that it's one of those things. Well, to refer to the first point, cartoon characters, like, there's no real reason to apply any sort of race like characteristics to them, because people, like, as I understand, like, people will get their own interpretation from it simply being a cartoon character. Like, a stick figure is a stick figure.
We didn't use any real, like, sort of, I think coded is the wrong word in this context, but we didn't. I mean, maybe there were some characters with Hispanic names.
I didn't remember any. Like, I that's the one thing I was looking out for in this whole game. I was like, well, I kind of, I know the product, I know KOL, so it's kind of a little bit. So it's like, I totally expect these guys are on the level, but I'm looking out for it anyway. And like, nothing blipped my radar. So
yeah, because I mean, I guess like nuns in that time would have probably been Mexican, right? But I don't remember if any of them have names.
I guess so. I think the only one is like the saints whose remains you're tasked to find. Like a couple of them.
Yeah, Santa Cortada. Saint Beefus is obviously
right.
A Russian.
Exactly. So you, Russian, you know, you start to like refer to maybe something real, and then it's Saint Beefus, whose massive thigh bone is a weapon that you can use. Yeah. So no, I that's what I'm saying though, is that I did really appreciate that. I don't think removing them entirely was a bad move, because I think the game was it's a parody of a kind of, you know, archetype that didn't really exist in the first place. I mean, cowboys were very different from the cowboys in this game. It's more like you're playing off of like Western media, but you're removing a really problematic and also unrealistic part of Western media.
Right.
So that's how I interpreted it. So I think if anybody's mad, then I don't know what reason they have to be, but you know, not my place to say.
So many people have in writing about the game have characterized it as being like, you know, if funny without being mean, and you know, just sort of warm and good-hearted, and that to me is like evidence that we achieved our aims with that. And that even looking back at some of the stuff that we put into KOL 15 years ago, we were never like edgelordy, but there's a lot more like Beavis and Butthead influence in I think both riffs in my earlier stuff, that maybe more in mine than in his, but yeah, I mean, we're old men now, you know, like it's just like, why not just be nice? It's, yeah. I think you end up with a better joke if you don't go for the easy joke.
Yeah. And none of the jokes in this game are easy. I praised highly the quality of writing, and I attributed it to the fact that y'all hadn't really had to worry about graphics in the past so many years. So obviously yeah. Your products have had to sell on the quality of their writing and humor.
And the quantity, I think, is also our sort of secret weapon, right? You look at this and it's a cheap game and you don't think, oh, this is going to have, you know, 15 hours worth of like non-repetitive stuff. Yeah. And then you're surprised when it does.
Yeah. No, like almost everything had some augmentation to it. Like it seemed like every battle that was in any way different from the previous one would have just this whole different set of like flavor text and descriptions. And man, it was just like reading a really funny book, like in a good way, of course.
How big is the script for the game?
Yeah, well, I don't know at this point. What was
300,000
when we were like vaguely tossing around the idea of the nightmare that would be localizing this game? We arrived at a count, and what was it, Kevin?
300,000 words.
Wow.
Oh, geez. Yeah, so it's sort of like six books.
Good Lord. I was gonna say, I think that's roughly half of Dragon Quest VII, which is one of the wordiest games of all time. Right?
So it's Paper Mario. Thousand Year Door.
It's one third of Paper Mario. Just the intro.
They got a lot of reading in store for you with Paper Mario.
But that's, you know, I think that's really our biggest strength as a studio is just the speed with which we can come up with. So part of it is like, we don't, you know, we'll edit stuff for typos, but we almost never edit stuff for quality. And it's like everything is just kind of the first draft, right?
So. Yeah, I get that sense a little bit, but in a way, that's kind of the thrill of it, is that these aren't like the most polished things. Like some stuff, you know, will maybe whiff, but it's like at the same time, you just appreciate that it's there. And then sometimes you find yourself like actually immersed in this like in this well-constructed arc of looking through nasty ass spittoons. That actually comes to a conclusion. I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but there is a conclusion to the story arc of sticking your hand in gross spittoons to look for items.
Yeah, Riff did a good job on those.
Yeah, that was. I really like that one.
I also appreciate the realistic feel to the writing, where everything isn't super overproduced and overwritten, and, you know, how many different rewrites of something until it's super, super polished. It feels more natural that way.
Yeah, we write really conversationally. You know, the we always just kind of treat the narrator as us talking to the player. I hadn't really thought about our style very much until they asked me to do a talk on comedy and games at GDC. And in putting it together, Riff and I kind of sat down and it's like, ah, crap, we have to sort of make a presentation about our approach to this, which made it so we had to kind of figure out what our approach is. We don't have like a style guide. It's just like, oh, we write stuff that we think is funny.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I like it. Okay, I have another question. And that is, I've played a little bit of KOL, but not a whole lot, so I'm not quite in on all the in jokes. So, but this one stuck out to me. What is the significance of the number 11?
Huh. Well, there is a band out of the Bay Area called Negative Land that has been around since the 70s, I think. And their stuff is real just noisy and sample heavy, and they're big sort of like IP law, what would you call it, like they really want sampling to be free and copyright infringement. Like they don't want at one point that band they released a song called U2, and they released it as a cassette, I think, because I think this was maybe prior to CDs, that just would, it said Negative Land in tiny letters at the bottom, and then U2 in like cover wide giant letters. And they obviously got sued by U2 for selling a thing that they were very clearly trying to trick people into thinking was a U2 album. And then they released another album later that was a bunch of songs, using samples of like people from U2 being interviewed and, stuff that came out of the coverage of this. So they did a lot of stuff like that. But there was an album that I really liked in high school, from them that had a song called Time Zones on it, which was just like maybe a 3-sentence recording of some crackpot calling into a talk show, talking about how big the Soviet Union is and asking, do you know how many time zones there are in the Soviet Union? And then the back half of the song is just these two people saying 11, 11. It's ridiculous. It's not even funny. And so just as this throwaway thing, whenever you got 11 of anything in KOL, I would just put the text, it's ridiculous. It's not even funny. And it just kind of became a trope of it. And 23 comes from like conspiracy stuff, and 37 comes from a joke in the movie Clerks. And so we just put
in a row.
Yeah. Oh, nice. And so like whenever we're trying to, and also like 11, 23, 37, 69 is a pretty balanced curve in terms of game system stuff. So we just end up doing a lot of stuff around those numbers.
Does 42 fit in there anywhere?
No, that was a little on the nose.
Yeah.
None of us felt like doing that.
That's getting into like Ready Player One territory. And these guys are professionals.
More just that in that one, like the number itself is the joke, I guess, in a way, right? It's not really a twist on anything. It's just, oh, this is just the joke that Douglas Adams made and we're making it again.
Yeah. Exactly.
37 though. I'm happy that you have something there for 37. It always makes my day when someone makes a Clerks reference.
It's also just like a really satisfying number. Like it's like cellar door 37. It's just like a good number. It just rolls off the tongue. I think it's prime. Is it prime?
It is. It is.
Chris with the math knowledge.
It's not very hard to know that one. Can anything divide into it? Second. No.
Maybe not hard for you. I don't.
Mr. Smart Guy over there.
We're all liberal arts majors.
Aw. I didn't even go to college.
Me neither.
Yay. But now we're doing podcasts. Hooray.
Yeah.
What do we have between us as a studio? I have a psychology degree. Riff has a graphic design. Riff, who does the writing, has a graphic design degree.
Which is why your characters are stick figures.
Kevin double majored in philosophy and theater.
Yep.
And did he make the graphics?
I did not.
No. I do all the graphics. The only role that only one of us does, I guess Wes is the only one who does animation.
This would be Wes of Loathing, right?
Wes of Loathing, correct, yeah. Now Wes Cleveland, our extremely talented animator, and Victor was the only one who really did like programming work in Unity, but everybody else kind of, you know, everybody has a little bit of writing in there. Everybody has a bunch of scripting. But yeah, the art, I guess, Kevin, you probably did some art stuff here and there. Yeah, it's harder than you would think to correctly ape the style of Loathing's art in a way that doesn't stand out as not fitting with it. It was, you know, a thing that was born out of necessity in the beginning, because when I started Kingdom of Loathing, it was just me. So I just drew, you know, this is how I can draw, like, which is to say I can't. But after doing it for 15 years, like it, I think became a cohesive style, and like you wouldn't describe it as being good art, but I think
it's intentional.
Yeah. It wouldn't work as well. It's not sloppy.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Super Mega Comics, and I've read the guy talk about how hard he works on facial expressions on his stick figure comics. Like, there's still an art to minimalist art like that. So
yeah, I actually he had me do a guest comic for the book that he kickstarted that was a collection of his early comics, and it was really hard. It was one of the hardest things that I've ever drawn, is at, like, actually replicating something that looked convincingly like a Super Mega comic.
Yeah.
Super Mega is very, very, very good. It's a little bit of an acquired taste. No, it's not.
It was instantly amazing.
Well, you know, okay, for normies.
What your first exposure to it was, because some of them are incredible and some of them are like...
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a sleeper. So
I love that he's, you know, most of my interaction with that comic now is getting notifications that he has refunded Patreon backings for a given month where he didn't produce anything. But every once in a while, there's an email with a new one, and it's so great.
He came out with one, and he did an audio version first, he did the film version rather first. So it's the one about Cheetos Never Change.
I have not seen that one.
It's on the Facebook page. You should look at it. It's great.
Well, I don't use Facebook.
Oh, well, something then. I'm sure it's somewhere.
Something then.
Get your game.com out. Connect to Super Mega.
Fully half of the people on this podcast right now can wholeheartedly recommend Super Mega Comics.
Absolutely. But yeah, no, I that's one thing about it, is that I found myself really liking the design of the characters, like, you know, based on how I was looking at them. And, like, combined with the writing, I think it really makes for making solid characters out of something that seems so minimal and something that, you know, a normie could easily sort of overlook.
Yeah, in the book Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud, there is this great page about sort of levels of abstraction in illustrating human faces and the different ways that the reader will be able to kind of interface with the drawings. And the gist of it, I guess, is that to a certain point, the more you abstract a face, the more relatable it can become to a person, because the more of the personality they kind of have to manufacture. So it's sort of the visual equivalent of writing, leaving more things to your imagination.
Yeah. And I like that most of the characters also seem to have more than one dimension to them. So, like, the person I partnered up with for the whole game was Alice, the doctor. And at first the joke seemed like, oh, okay, well, she drinks a lot. But, like, there's so much more to her. And I found myself really, really, like, really fond of her by the end of the game.
Yeah, Riff did almost all of the partner writing. There were, I think I wrote the very first conversation with Gary to kind of set the tone for
and
that.
He's the crazy codger, right?
No, that's Pete. Gary's the goblet. Gary's the goblet, the sort of hidden fourth partner that you can take with you. Is the just goofball goblin guy? Yeah, I think we had a hard time. We sort of decided, all right, well, Alice hates the undead. Why might she, you know, tragic backstory, you know, that's a decent thing. You know, as Westworld has taught us, a tragic backstory is necessary to bring a character to life. And then Susie hates cows, similar, almost the exact same tragic backstory. And with Pete, it was a little harder because, like, because the idea was like, oh, Pete's scared of mines, but then that just means that he can't really do anything in them. Or he's like kind of scared of technology. And with like, you know, in a game that's largely about fighting skeletons and fighting cows and exploring mines and technology, it's easier to have stuff to do with the people who are antagonistic towards the things that you're fighting, yeah, as opposed to antagonistic towards the things that you want the most to do.
I think you'll call them thematically convenient.
Yeah,
totally cool.
Tell us more about the goblin. I didn't know that you could partner up with the goblin in the game.
We make it unlikely that you'll stumble on it by accident, because you have to go to the room that he's in that you can only get into if you've been asked to kill him or it. I think we decided that goblins just don't have gender, and so you have to go down there, not kill the goblin, and then go back later after you've learned to speak goblin, and then you can, I'm spoiling this for anybody who's listening, but it's a thing that, like, you have to be pretty thorough and pretty patient to stumble on.
I appreciate that, because it's really nice to have that layer of depth for people who maybe gone through the whole game twice to, like, try and see everything, and then realize that, oh, there's actually more.
Yeah, and he also speeds up a bunch of stuff, because we just sort of decided that when you have Gary as the partner, we just don't let you kill any other goblins, and so you end up with kind of easy mode on all of the quests that involve dealing with goblins, because if you speak goblin, you can do a sort of a non-combat version of that stuff even without him, but with him, we still give you the option to fight them.
But with him, we just don't.
So, no, go ahead.
I enjoyed all of the dialogue that happens when you raise your intimidating stat up. So I maxed it out pretty early. So I think I haven't killed a goblin at all since the opening of the game.
Those are the hardest ones for us to do. Because we decided that every character class was going to have a speech skill. And we ended up with one that we didn't really like writing, and then two that were basically the same thing as each other, which is, we've been talking about that a lot for what we would do in a future game, like the way that we would try to differentiate this. Cause intimidating is it's kind of inherently mean and violent, and we don't really play up those aspects of the humor as much. So.
Right. I think it's really good the way it's written. In fact, I think the specific charm of the intimidating writing that I liked is that it's a little bit ineffective and yet it works. I think that's a special brand of comedy. I don't know how to define it exactly, but just something being inept and yet totally effective.
I think part of the reason we didn't like writing those as much as the other ones is they were just harder to pull off.
Right. No, I quite enjoyed it, actually. It made me want to have an intimidating cowpuncher.
That's one of the biggest differences on replay, actually, is that there's almost everything that you can use one speech skill on, you can use all of them on, and they all have different ways that they play out, both mechanically and in the writing, per class. So even a lot of the random encounters play out pretty differently and have different jokes in them based on what class you are.
Oh, yeah.
I love the classes in the game, too. It's just so ridiculous. Cowpuncher.
Yeah.
Yep.
Snake Oilers. Which
history
in my review...
History kind of handed us Cowpuncher and Snake Oiler as a... well, not oil, you know, Snake Oil is a thing, yeah. And then Beanslinger just came from, the longstanding loathing tradition of magic being about cooking.
Nice.
I interrupted you. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I was actually going to talk about the Beanslingers or whatever. And just be like, where did that come from? And you just said it. I think I said, in my review, I forgot Snake Oilers. I blanked on the name of it. So sorry to everybody who listened to the review. The third class is Snake Oiler.
Okay, no one listened.
That's all right, yeah.
That's the one sort of divergence from KOL is in KOL, the Moxie classes, the sort of rogue archetypes are all sort of based around music. They're disco bandits and accordion thieves.
Yeah.
And we just, none of us could come up with anything that we liked for a sort of punchy name for a kind of music-based Moxie class. So we thought, well, let's just say that that was an accident of tradition and that we're not totally bound by it.
Yeah, and actually, I think Snake Oil is perfect. Like, that's absolutely an archetype that somebody who's seen some Westerns before. Plus, it reminds me of the guy from Pete's Dragon, who's like one of my favorite Disney villains because he's so absurd.
I've never seen Pete's Dragon, so maybe either all riff or entirely unintentional.
I guess I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely the antagonist of the film is a snake oil salesman who wants to chop up the dragon and you know make medicine out of him that doesn't work.
That tracks.
Yeah. So that was definitely an archetype where I was like, oh, that's clever. Whereas initially I was like, accordion thief. That sounds more like an in joke.
Yeah. I mean, it's the class in KOL that's the hardest to write stuff for.
And it was the one I picked too, which is funny.
We did okay, I think, eventually at coming up with like skills and enough content to support it. But it's just accordions are not as inherently like rich as disco.
Yeah, and I know I'm very glad that y'all brought back disco for this game very briefly.
Yeah,
I kind of imagine that's what that was meant to be, because I didn't really understand the whole Kurtz thing until I saw the dance room, and I was like, oh, well, they just wanted to animate some goofy ass dancing.
Yeah, and I like make fun of CrossFit in a kind of a good-natured way. That's
absolute props to whoever wrote the disco song where they used the banjo as the melody.
Yeah, that's Ryan Eich, our composer and sound designer. The soundtrack was really just a treasure.
Yes, A+.
Is the soundtrack available anywhere?
Yeah, Bandcamp, I think, is the place where Ryan gets the most money for it. And it's also available on Steam.
I like Bandcamp.
Nice. I'll have to grab it on Bandcamp so that I can play some of the songs on the show.
Yeah.
It's all about that public domain Joe.
that was me, actually. That's not on the soundtrack.
Really?
I can send you an MP3 and sweet. Give you permission.
Exclusive, yes.
Yep. No, for those, because the joke there was that they were like sort of bad children's arrangements of songs on the player piano because they didn't pay for any real music for it. I used Chris Remo's piano at the Campo Santo office to just record some extremely made up kids versions of public domain songs. Not that the Rednecks version of Cotton Eye Joe is public domain, but I doubt if they're going to come after me.
Yeah. And by the way, the quest that's attached to that was one of the tougher ones for me. Where you have to find the bandits.
Yeah,
the Potemkin game? Is that what it was?
No, those are the ones in the fake city.
Right. That was one of my favorites, though. I actually really liked that one.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased with the way that turned out. The bandit things ended up being so much more work than all of the other stuff because they all required a bunch of weird features of the scripting language that ended up, you know, working really well and being really valuable elsewhere in the game. But those things took forever to implement compared to a lot of the other stuff.
Yeah. Also, there's in the Potemkin one with the made up town, there's that musical joke that I really appreciate, which I don't know if you want to give it away, but
yeah. And you know what's weird though is that the soundtrack for the front side of it, we changed the song, and so it's like the back is sort of a joke about the song that used to be playing in that zone. That was just kind of an accident.
I thought it sounded slightly different, but I don't listen to backwards track stuff all the time, so
why not?
I'm not one
it's
of those
so
guys.
Fun to do.
Yeah.
How else are you going to learn about Satan?
Yeah, exactly. How else are you going to learn, kid?
Oh my lord! But I'm curious though.
There you go. The first step in learning about Satan is to refer to him as your lord.
Oh yeah, of course.
Got
to show the proper respect.
Very true. I was going to ask, did you guys add any kind of new content for the Switch version of the game?
No.
Subtle tweaks here and there.
Yeah, it'll instead of like I think Kevin went through and every place that the game refers to you as refers to your computer. But most of the work of the port was in building in controller support, Well, okay, so there was like a day of building in controller support and then 2 months of redoing all of the UI to make it make sense with a controller.
So does the added controller support mean that we might see it on other consoles?
We're not against it. There are no specific plans, and I think it would we'd want to wait a little while.
Makes sense.
Either way, but yeah, I think the game makes so much more sense on Switch than it does on a PS4 or an Xbox. You know, I anticipate that on those platforms, it would probably make its money back since it would be less work to port to them than it was to the Switch owing to reusing a lot of the Switch work. But, you know, it's not anything that we're just like champing at the bit for the way we were the Switch version, because we're all like 40-year-old dudes who grew up playing Nintendo, and the idea of having, you know, a game that we made on their platform was just very, very exciting to us.
Yeah, I remember when you guys were on the first time, you mentioned how you just really wanted to have a game on a Nintendo system, and I was excited when I saw it was announced for the Switch that your goal happened.
Yeah, no, it's a trip.
And on, like, the best Nintendo system that's come out in a while.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's really good.
So glad y'all didn't make it to the Wii U.
I mean, the Wii U well enough, actually. I mean,
me too. But it's publisher poison.
Well,
so, you know, y'all dodged a bullet there. It's a good system.
In the Wii U days, they were also... I don't think that... It sort of wasn't until the Switch that they... I think kind of got the way that they needed to approach American indie games. And I don't think they would have let us on a platform in an earlier generation just owing to the content.
Oh, nice. Yeah. See, I don't know that side of it.
I mean, cause for a long time, you know, like The Binding of Isaac was supposed to come out on the 3DS, but they just wouldn't approve the content unless he, you know, compromised it to a point where he was unwilling to. But then on the Switch, it's just, but there it is. I think they finally kind of just gave up, and or maybe like the Switch finally has good enough parental controls that they felt comfortable putting in.
Maybe.
Also, it is on the new 3DS.
Oh, is it?
It's a new 3DS exclusive. It's one of the first ones that came out with the system.
Oh, crazy!
Yeah, it's on there now. They needed that second stick for sure.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, yeah, it's probably also a content thing too.
What content do you think would have rubbed Nintendo the wrong way?
Probably all the drinking. There's not like, you know, there's the occasional like piss or hell for effect, but generally it's not like super vulgar, but it does. You know, there's like a special category of ESRB thing that's like, does the game reward you in the game systems for the use of alcohol and drugs? It's like, well, yes.
Absolutely. It's kind of one of the pillars upon which I think the loathing stands.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, if there had been restrictions on the content to that level, we just wouldn't have done it, because I don't think that... I think that would be too fundamental a compromise to make.
We dodged a bullet by not referencing any sort of modern-day illegal drugs in the game, because that would have pushed us over the edge into immature, which I think would have caused a lot of sort of cascading problems. Like, we could not have been on for sale in Australia, for example, with that rating.
Yeah, I was going to say, and it really, I mean, as far as, like, drug references in West of Loathing goes, it reminded me more of, like, propaganda stuff from the 60s than anything that's actually real.
Yeah, I mean, the only real-ish thing in there is the laudanum, which is, you know, I guess it would still be illegal if anyone still made it or wanted it.
But it was legal at the time, too.
And the flavor text description, y'all don't really give away what it is in the flavor text. You're just like, this is fine. Which I really like that sometimes y'all will just give up on being illicit and just be like, this seems like it's all well and good.
Yeah. This is probably safe.
That's probably fine.
Probably.
Yeah, that's big.
You probably shouldn't drink this, like the demonic cow's blood or something.
And again, it's the same game that says you shouldn't put your hand in a spittoon, and we all know that there's goodies in every spittoon.
They don't tell you not to do it. They just really discourage it.
Are you sure? Are you really, really sure?
I didn't really stick to this, but the first one, I deliberately... I wrote the sort of outline for the script and then Riff filled in the writing on it. And I deliberately made the buttons that you had to click to go forward different every time so that you actually had to read it carefully.
Yes.
We didn't really stick to that. It got by fine on the strength of just the writing and not, we didn't need to draw extra attention to it.
Yeah. This is not the kind of game where I think anybody wants to skip any text at all. Like I found
that's a good feeling.
Yeah, for a couple of battles, I like kind of felt myself like starting to scroll through, and I was like, wait, I haven't seen this one yet. And then I like stop and then actually read it, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we took pains to make it not repetitive for that. It was the bulk of random encounters that we ended up with in it is less than we were hoping, but I think still a ton, and I think enough. Like, you don't... In a normal playthrough, I don't think you're going to see the same random encounter more than twice, maybe, so.
Nah. I mostly just opened up the mausoleum in the Dave yard, but that's because I had Alice, and so fighting more skeletons with her made her more powerful, and so I was
And made it easier, too, yeah, that's it.
Yeah. So I did that, just because I'm a grinding person, so I actually really enjoy doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, me too. There was a lot of internal debate about whether we wanted to include those just sort of infinitely grindable things, just because I think Kevin, maybe you should articulate what the, and it wasn't like fights about it, it was just like discussions.
With your fists.
I want to protect the player from behavior that I think isn't going to be fun. So like in a situation where you know that you can derive benefit from sort of doing the same thing over and over again, but without really thinking about it or enjoying it, some people like me, will be drawn to that and just sit there and do it and sort of power up their character there. And if you just remove that, like you don't have to design it such that that's possible. And Zach's point, I think, was an interesting and valid one, which was like, if you want to get a skill and you're, you know, a couple hundred experience points away from it, knowing that there are places that you can go and just sort of grind that out without having to think about it can be really, advantageous. And like, I feel like people were divided about 50-50 in sort of anecdotal experience about whether they felt like that was good or not. It was reported as a bug a lot in testing. It's like, oh, I don't think you should be allowed to do this, because like people were out of that sort of mindset. It's an interesting sort of divisive thing. Do you let people sort of just collect arbitrary resources in a game that where it's not like it's not a multiplayer game, so it's not like there's an economy that you can screw up or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is something that we think about a lot with KOL because there is a player economy. You can't sort of just let you arbitrarily collect stuff. So
I think it was implemented exactly where it needed to be. Like, I think there's 3 points where you can fight skeletons that are increasingly harder, and skeletons are of course great with Alice because she can instant kill them. And then there's the one where you can grind up the robot, the El Vibrato, and get those pieces, which can be kind of annoying to just find on the map, you know, randomly if you're actually trying to complete that really quickly.
Yeah.
So I appreciated it. Also, I really like, speaking of that part of the game, I actually really like that you get to essentially learn a whole different language that, you know, even if you don't learn it in the game, if you pay attention, like you can actually start to translate it yourself because it's consistent. So...
Yeah, I was pretty happy with the way that turned out. That happened pretty late in development because I was kind of intimidated by, like, I wanted to get it right. You know, I think it's a thing that it's not for everybody. Like, that's definitely kind of a grindy part of the game, and I like a certain amount of grind. Like, I genuinely enjoy just, I'm just going to zone out and fight for a while, and at the end of it, I'm going to be stronger.
Yeah, I thought it was a cool mystery because it shows up pretty early in the game, in the first little sort of area before, you know, the tracks go across the mountains. So I found myself being very drawn to it and being like, ooh, what's this? This is mysterious. I wonder what it's going to, you know, unfold into. And then, it just turns out to be something that's really beneficial to complete, but not like essential or anything. Although I will say that it definitely is making me want to see a Loathing in Space.
Yeah.
So maybe that could be on the docket someday.
Someday.
Yep.
I just kind of got to figure it out. It, like, the space games that I like tends to be games where, well, this is not entirely true, but like Star Control 2 is one of my favorite video games of all time. And that is definitely like, I think the touchstone that we would have in making a Loathing space game. But in Star Control 2, you are way more the ship than you are the captain. You know, you're nominally the captain, but you don't have that much of a character. And I think that I would want to try to make something that played more like a Mass Effect, because that way you're actually just like a guy running around in rooms and spaces fighting stuff. Like I have a hard time imagining translating our graphics into making a convincing space thing, which is, everybody else just looks at me like I'm crazy when I say I cannot picture a space Loathing game in my head yet. And I think I'll get there eventually, but
put a circle around the head for the helmet and there you're set.
Well, right, but it's like a black and white game. So what color is space? Space is black. Okay. Does that mean the lines are white? Are the lines, everything is like black lines, but with a white outline around it? Is it like,
everything. And you're
keeps me up at night.
like what was that Game Boy game? Solar Striker?
Oh yeah.
Where you rolled around white space, but then once it was on Game Boy Color, it was like, no, wait, they colorized that one in a different way. But yeah. Like
that's weird. That I feel like that you are the second person I've met who is even aware of that game. It's like one of just a handful of games that I had for my original Game Boy as a kid.
It was an interesting experiment in making a vertical shooter on the Game Boy, because it was so early on and it's a Nintendo first party game. So really? Yeah, it's a really interesting game. Mm-hmm. It's not very good, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's like a lot of Game Boy stuff, right? Like there were some good games on there, and then there were some games like, huh, this was an ambitious failure.
There were such good games on the Game Boy later on that used such cool like technological gimmicks and stuff and never came to the U.S. They stayed in Japan. Mm. But anyway,
like what?
Well, I want to subscribe to your newsletter, Chris.
All right,
I do too. What games had these weird technological advances? Like you're just full of trivia today. Holy shit!
So I'd have to Google it though, and we're in an interview, but. There's a vertical shooter on the Game Boy that utilized this weird way of like splitting the graphical planes where I can't remember the technological details of it, but it ended up being this really good looking vertical shooter. And I can't remember the name of it either, but if you want to buy a cartridge, they're like $300 on eBay because collectors know about it.
I'd rather buy component cables for GameCube.
Yeah, 1.5.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I think that's a wiser investment.
Split into 4.5 colors.
Yeah. it's there's a really good vertical shooter on the Game Boy, and it never came to the U.S. And but yeah, then like different things like that. Trip World is another really cool one that I don't think ever came over here, but it was like a Sunsoft game that had like this really awesome soundtrack that I think was made by the Manami Matsumai who did Mega Man. But and it was gorgeous looking. But yeah.
You're too smart, Chris.
No, I only care about one thing.
Video games.
And now I'm just old, so I've been looking at them for a very long time.
Oh man.
But go ahead.
Oh no, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, if you want to be inspired by a good comedy spaceship game takes place in space, check out Vostok Inc. And that was programmed by one lady. I later found out after reviewing it.
Yeah, that's a pretty crazy one.
Yeah, it's a twin stick shooter. Oh,
yeah, I've played that.
Yeah. Twin stick shooter / capitalism simulator.
It's good. I remember it reminded me a little bit of, there is a game that I can never remember the name of the game or of the studio. It's like Moon Pod by Stardock or Star Blast by Moon Pod. it was like late 90s, I want to say, but it's like this kind of sprawling, flying around space, shooting stuff to get stuff to upgrade your ship and fly to new places. And
oh, nice.
So anyway, put that vague nonsense in the show notes. Why don't you?
Yeah.
Stardock Moon Pod Games?
I think Moon Pod is the name of the studio, but I do not remember the name of the game.
Yeah, I'm trying to find this shit out.
Well, while we're vaguely remembering space games that we don't know the titles to, in 2006 I played this one really obscure indie game on the PC that was like flying around different planets and setting up trade deals and stuff. And like there was no combat involved. It was just a trade simulator, but in space. And it had little voice samples and things like that. And I remember it being pretty good, but I cannot remember what it's called at all. So there you go.
All right, Kevin, now you do one.
I remember playing a bunch of Escape Velocity Override, but I don't feel like that's super obscure or whatever.
I think the closest thing to obscure that I ever enjoyed was a game called Great Greed on the Game Boy.
I have that too.
A food-themed RPG.
Yeah, it was amazing. I beat it.
So is it called like, Starscape?
I don't know. Maybe.
Starscape Dimension Drive or Starscape Aegis Warps In?
Maybe, yeah.
I'm on the Moon Pod website. They also have a game called Word Pirate, which looks incredible.
Word Pirate.
Can't go wrong with Word Pirate. Oh, man. Well, I know we've been chatting for well over an hour now. Chris, did you have any other questions you wanted to ask? I think you asked two.
I asked three.
Three?
Because okay. I asked about They Might Be Giants and the number 11 and Loathing in Space. Which I only just wanted.
That seems pretty good to me.
I just wanted to call it that because Lost in Space.
It's almost like a Kevin Smith, one of his stand-up specials where somebody asks a question and then he talks for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Fucking love Kevin Smith.
Well, you know, we're all a bunch of white dudes. We all have five dots in podcasting about nothing.
Damn, he's figured us out.
Hey, it's not hard to figure this show out. It's pretty easy.
That's true.
But yeah, did you have any other questions? Anything else you wanted to ask?
I'm good. I think this is great.
This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think I'm anticipating a thunderstorm that sounds like a guy peeing. So might be time to go.
Cool. Well, Kevin, Zach, it has been fantastic having you guys back on the show again. Last thing I wanted to ask is what's next with you guys?
We're working on some DLC that we're hoping to have out in the not too distant future. And then we'll figure out how to deploy DLC to 40 platforms. and, you know, we're doing pre-production work on the next game in the series. We'll get back to work on the iOS port. And anything I'm forgetting, Kevin?
No, those are the major pillars.
And we're continuing to work on Kingdom of Loathing all the time because we sort of have to.
Right.
Good stuff. And I'm still going to keep my fingers crossed for an Xbox version, just like I said last time. I hope I will throw money at my TV if it happens.
Well, maybe 9 months from now, a new bundle of joy will arrive.
Fingers crossed. Magic happens twice. But yeah,
and our lawyers will be in touch about the support payments.
Oh, man. But yes, it has been fantastic having you guys on chatting. Kevin, do you have any final words to end the interview?
Be good to one another.
Aw.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for sticking around. Another thanks to Zach and Kevin at Asymmetric for coming on and chatting with us, and to Chris Taylor for joining as well. But we got more show to get to. Cole, you're here. How are you doing?
I'm here. I mean, I still have a dislocated knee.
Still?
Yeah. I mean, it's been over a week since I injured it, and I've still got another one. Right? I've got another week before I can even have an MRI. So
why so long before you can get an MRI?
My insurance had a shit fit and didn't want to pay for it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because the first hospital I went to just said it was a sprain. So they're saying, oh, it's just a sprain, and you don't need an MRI for a sprain.
Nice.
But, I mean, my kneecap was hanging out the side of my leg. So I think it's a little worse than a sprain.
Yeah, just a smidge. That sounds like Ashley, where the employee healthcare or whatever, they wouldn't let her get an MRI because they didn't think it was anything important. So she kind of went on her own and had it done and found out that she had a tear in her knee.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, so. I'm really afraid of what the doctor is going to find when they do the MRI. I don't know what's worse.
Skittles.
I don't know if it's worse. I like Skittles. I don't know if it's worse for them to be like, oh yeah, you tore up everything. Or if it's worse for them to be like, quit being a whiny bitch. Nothing's wrong with you.
Well, because you scanned your knee and it looks like all your shit is fucked up.
You know, it's like, which one do you really want it to be? There's no win.
Either things are fine and you look like a whiner, or things are really fucked up and you're proven right, but then things are really fucked up.
Things are really fucked up. And that's the thing, like, I don't want to brag, but I live with a horrible disease that causes me pain every day. So I have quite a pain tolerance.
I don't want to brag, like but my shit's all fucked up.
You know, I'm just not bothered by... I popped the fucking thing back in place myself sitting in the middle of the living room floor. So I'm not really the kind of person who panics over a little bit of pain. This shit hurts. This is worse than the C-sections I had. Somebody needs to fix this thing.
You left an important detail out, though. You fixed it yourself on the dining room floor, living room floor, or dining room floor?
Living room floor.
Living room
while
floor.
While covered in dog puke.
There's the detail I was looking
for. Yeah. While covered in dog puke, I grabbed a hold of my own kneecap and popped it back into socket.
Man. That was so fun hearing Chris's reaction to the story last week. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm here too. Oh, yeah, there's a reason you're just skipping over me. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got some news to talk about. Should we dive into the news?
Let's talk about things that aren't my injuries.
How about you start off? Because I know there's something you want to talk about.
I want to talk about the new Rocket Pass in Rocket League.
What is that?
A nightmare.
Helpful.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm jumping the gun in assumptions. But basically, it's modeled after the Fortnite Battle Pass. Where they will have a season, if you will, and you can gain XP to unlock rewards, which is kind of what already happens, which is a little weird for them to be going for the whole pass mode. Because as it currently is, you level up and every so often you just get shit. Mm-hmm. it's
so
a lot
what
of
difference is the
shit.
Pass?
So the pass is actually going to have like a whole separate XP system. And again, you will unlock shit, but it is supposed to be more worthwhile shit.
Mm.
There will be two versions of it. There will be a free and a premium. The free pass is going to have like car bodies and customizable items, whereas and decryptors. And if you're not familiar with what a decryptor is in Rocket League, it's basically a key that lets you unlock the loot boxes. But there's a hitch to the decryptors in that anything you get out of a loot box with a decryptor cannot be traded. You're stuck with it, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
However, if you upgrade and have the premium pass, you will get, not just decryptors and car bodies and stuff, but you will get actual keys. Anything you unlock with a key can be traded.
Mm.
So it's a big difference, but the extra difference is that a Rocket Pass will cost 10 keys or $10.
Monthly?
Whatever the equivalent. That is the other hitch. According to Psyonix, they want to do several passes a year. It's a very vague, generalized term. Like when I heard a Rocket Pass, I thought, okay, this could be seasonal, whereas you get a pass and it's good for 3 or 4 months and then they do another one. But it seems like they want to do more than 3 or 4 a year. And this is where we're getting into excessive territory. I was really happy initially with the whole Rocket Pass thing.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why. Loot crates are awful.
yeah, they are. But Rocket League kind of made their name off them.
And the Rocket League crates are especially bad. I've already mentioned the whole difference between the decryptor and the keys, but you can pay cash for keys and open crates all day long and never get the item you want. It's just a toss-up.
Yeah.
I've used... You can get the decryptors when they have special events, like when they did the spring event. Right now they're doing the summer one where they give you the little arbitrary seashells. You use them. You can buy decryptors and crates and open them for free, which is good, and I appreciate that they do it, but there is always one goal explosion in those fucking crates, and it will be the only thing I want, and I can get all 5 decryptors, which is all they'll allow you to have, and get 47 of the same skin for a car I don't use that I can't trade because I use the decryptor. And never get the fucking goal explosions. And I've said repeatedly a million times, I would very happily just give you guys a dollar for a goal explosion.
Yeah.
And
what they're doing this week.
Where my mouth is.
What, I was going to say what they're doing this week where they have the Jurassic Park DLC or the Jurassic World DLC for $2 with a vehicle and a goal explosion.
I put my money where my mouth was, and as soon as I saw that, I bought it.
Yeah, same.
And
here.
I shit you not. I haven't used any of the cars, the player banners, nothing. I just wanted that goal explosion. I paid $2 for it, and I am obscenely happy, and I giggle every time I score.
That's all they got to do. Just let people buy what they want to buy.
Just let me buy what I wanted. And it was kind of crummy. It was like, well, I paid $2, and I got all that other shit I don't care about. But I'm so happy. I've got my $2 worth out of that dinosaur the first night because every time it popped up and I scored, I'd put "rawr" in chat just to piss people off. And it was amazing. Amazing.
Oh, you're an asshole.
I know it.
Rawr.
So many people have quit. So many people have cussed me. It has been so worth the $2. And I would do it over and over and over again for goal explosions that I wanted if it were just an option. So
yeah,
if the Rocket Pass was going to eliminate the crates completely and make that a viable thing, I'd be so happy.
Yeah, that'd be nice. I think that's one of the biggest things that bothers me about Rocket League is the loot crates and pay to buy keys to unlock them. Like, I can understand getting the seashells and using an in-game currency to unlock shit, but paying real money for random things, I hate it. I hate it, and I will never support it.
Yeah, I have not paid cash to unlock any of the boxes. Because to me, it's not worth the risk. There is no guarantee if you use a key that you're going to get something you don't already have.
Mm-hmm.
None. And I have shitty enough luck that I've already got 4 of the skins of the rabbit that I can't trade off. So I don't want a 5th. I don't. I want the goal explosion. And I just want to be able to give you a dollar and you give me the goal explosion.
Well, you will never get it.
I will never get it. And it makes me sad. I want the flower one. I know that's ridiculous. During the Halloween event, I was all about the bats. And then the spring event, I was like, oh, I want the flowers. Because you know that just pisses people off.
No. You're pretty.
I have a pink car with a purple unicorn horn. And it blows rainbow flowers out of its ass. So you know... said if I hit a goal and the explosion was flowers, it was going to piss somebody off. I get called horrible things anyway, so I might as well just keep pouring salt in the wound.
Yeah, might as well. Go big or go home, right?
Exactly. Look, if I had it my way, somebody at Psyonix would be creating me a goal explosion that just like poofs pink glitter and then a little herd of unicorns go running across the field. Oh, that's what I need.
Oh, my Lord.
You know how happy I'd be? Just poof, glitter and a little horde of unicorns.
So you're waiting for the My Little Pony crossover.
Basically.
Nice. So
there are unicorns in every other way, so you might as well let me have the unicorn goal explosion.
Is there any other info on that pass to mention?
I mentioned the 2 forms, that there's the premium and the free. If you don't buy the premium right away, your progress on the free one, if you say like you wait till mid-season, maybe there's a sale or whatever, and you get it closer to the end of the season at a fraction of the price or whatever, then all of your progress from the rest of the season is retroactive, and you will get all those rewards. You don't miss out on them. It doesn't start when you buy it. It starts when the event starts and carries on through. So your progress is retroactive, which is really good. So then you don't miss out on the opportunity to get all the shit that you should have earned. Even if you do just play for free and then decide at the end, oh, well, maybe I did want that after all. Another positive thing is that you will be able to see every item that you can earn before you buy the pass.
Oh, that's good.
So there is no, guess. The biggest question mark becomes then, am I going to have enough time put into the game to justify the price of trying to get whatever item I'm wanting the most if it's a higher end item?
No.
The other thing is that it can take, they're looking at making it take up to 100 hours to complete a battle pass.
Fuck that. Holy shit.
So that is a lot of time in Rocket League. And this is kind of problematic if they're going to do rapid fire rocket passes throughout the year. Because that's a lot of time and not enough. I get that they're trying to force scarcity with the higher end items and so that they're more valuable and have more trade clout. But
people have lives.
If you're paying for it, it shouldn't be that obscenely difficult. And I say that as I put a shit ton of time in Rocket League. I play it, even though I've had the completion, I play the ever-loving fuck out of it. So I don't know that I could even put in 100 hours in, say, a month or even a month and a half to because I have other shit to play.
Yeah.
So it does kind of draw away from the whole, oh, well, I'd buy it, but I just don't know if I'm going to have the time to get my money's worth out of it.
Yeah.
So it'll be curious to see, how that really pans out. How long of a gap is there going to be for each event is kind of the biggest question for me.
Yeah. Well, if only Chris was here this week, I'm sure you and him could do like 2 full hours just on Rocket League.
This would be a 4-hour show and we'd never even get to any of the other news.
Hey, we've had 2 4-hour shows in the past. I wouldn't mind seeing another one somewhere pop up. But let's see, what other news is there coming out? Microsoft has said that they are no longer planning to support VR with the Xbox One or the One X, and says that PC is, quote, probably the best platform for virtual and mixed reality. What do you think of that?
VR was one of my E3 predictions. So I'm a little surprised. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing because I just would rather see more focus on the games that are coming to Xbox being the best games we could get rather than Microsoft feeling like they need to dump money into VR games to try to promote a mixed reality system as well.
Yeah.
Like, we're just not in the game sphere to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think it's a smart idea. I'm thinking that they saw how underwhelming I think the PSVR reception has been. I mean, it's done pretty well for a VR system, but it didn't set the world on fire like I think people were expecting or hoping it to do. It's a cool system, but it definitely has its limitations. I've always said I would love to see VR done with the Kinect. I think that's the right way to do it, but I guess we're not going to see that happen anytime soon.
I think too that there's the aspect of there's not enough developers in that space. Even third-party developers are few and far between, and I think trying to push VR on Xbox would lead to another Kinect-type scenario where we just don't have enough developers that are willing to support it, and it would have just floundered. So it's not a bad idea to skip it as much as you'd like to see that kind of innovation come about.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that there would be an issue with developers being there. I think that there's more the issue of the audience being there. Look how many units the PS4 has sold. they're like 80 million, something ridiculous like that.
Yeah.
And they're at like not even 2 million PSVR sold.
That's a pretty low adoption rate.
Like the last I heard a couple months ago, they just hit 1 million. So I honestly don't know what they're at right now, but I know I haven't heard anything about hitting 2 million.
Yeah.
So if I'm wrong, please someone correct me. I hate being wrong, although I, you know, like talking a lot. So
if you were wrong, I'd be the first person to yell at you.
Nice. let's see what else. Darwin Project is going free to play on Xbox One starting the 4th of July. As you drop this and break shit.
I did. I expected this to happen. Well, not when I was reviewing the game.
It went free to play on PC already, so yeah, it's about time.
They made the, you know, big announcement. It was going free to play on PC, and at the time they were like, you know, Xbox will have news for you soon. And so it's been, what, maybe 2 months? It wasn't a shock it was going to happen. I don't think it's a bad thing that it's happening. I do think it's kind of the Fortnite effect. And I'm curious to see what's in the Founders Edition, because I did not check when it went live on Steam what the Founders Pack included.
They announced that it's pretty much just a bunch of cosmetics in there. They said that the game will never be pay to win or pay for an advantage, which, fingers crossed, they stick to that. And that if you bought the game before June 22nd, you'll get that in-game Founders Pack. Or if you prefer, you could contact Microsoft Support and get a refund if you paid for it and don't want the Founders Pack.
Oh, interesting.
Yep.
I think that, you know, at least they're offering refunds if you don't want to fuck with it after it goes free. Or if you, you know, it's game preview. Yeah.
I think so still. Yeah.
Because they're still, like, they hadn't finished fleshing out Duos or anything like that. I think Duos is coming, though, still. Because there was a mention of friend invites and stuff like that. But it's, for free, it's absolutely a try-it kind of game anyway. I enjoyed my time with it. But I was afraid when I did play it that the community just isn't going to be overwhelming for it the way it is. Because of the nature of how the Battle Royale market is becoming so saturated.
Yeah.
It was kind of a little late to the game, unfortunately. But the whole aspect of having the director and stuff, it was a lot of fun. It's really, really neat. But
so hopefully this will turn the game around and get more people involved with it.
Yeah. It's always an option. But I hope it doesn't kill it off in the end.
Yeah.
Because I did have fun.
Oh, good to hear that it's fun, at least. I still haven't dabbled with it. I really need to, eventually.
I liked being the director and having people cuss at me for not helping them.
You get people cursing at you a lot, don't you?
I do. I'm kind of... I don't mean to be a shitheaded player. It's just that, you know, when you're particularly good at things, people get jelly, and then they cuss you. I get a lot of hate mail.
Oh, God. How many do you report?
I only report the ones that make, like, crude sexist type remarks to me. I get a lot of those, though, unfortunately. If people just message me cussing at me or whatever, I don't care. But once it gets, like, overtly sexual or abusive regarding my gender, and it happens, then those are the ones where I'm like, nah, you gotta go. Bye. Nice.
Speaking of toxic fan base or player bases, a new game was added to the backward compatibility lineup this week. Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3. So we know the Call of Duty scene is just filled with pleasant people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Modern Warfare 3, that was so much hate mail back in the day.
Well, now you can get more.
That. I'm going to go play that. And that's what I'm doing after the show.
Nice.
I'm going to go digging through my drawers, see if I still got one of my Modern Warfare 3 discs.
I wonder if the price went up at GameStop yet. It was only $8 on Tuesday when they announced it.
I have no doubt that it's going to be like $30 now.
Yeah, we were guessing $24.99.
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say $29.99.
Yeah. Oh no, we're both wrong. It's only $14.99. So they only doubled the price.
Doubles.
Oh, let's see. Achievement fans can now get some achievements on the Switch. The Minecraft Better Together Bedrock version is now officially out, so crossplay is finally there, as well as Xbox achievements. If people do want to play that version on the Switch, they will have to sign up for a Microsoft account. It will be required so that all your mine coins and everything else can carry through. If you already own the original Minecraft for Nintendo Switch version, you can get the new one as a free upgrade. Either find it in the store and grab it if you got it digital, or apparently in-game, they have prompts there on how to get the new version. So that's good that people who already own it get the free version, free upgrade.
The Twitter love between Nintendo and Xbox today was so good.
Oh, I know. I'm telling you, there's gonna be something behind them. They've got to have some kind of big something. There's something has to come of this. They're just
there's
too friendly.
Be a Nintendo Direct, and it's just gonna blow everybody's brains.
I'm waiting for the reveal of like Minecraft Steve or Banjo Kazooie in fucking Smash Brothers. I think it's going to happen. We have to have something like that happen.
Ori. They could put Ori in Smash Bros. Because Ori's in Rivals of Aether, so.
Oh, man. That would be crazy if that happened.
Yeah. That's a thing that could happen. Think about it.
I wonder if Microsoft would be okay with Ori releasing on the Switch.
I can't imagine why not.
Because I think they own the IP for it, so I don't know if they would be like, I don't know. I still think Rare Replay should be on the Switch, so I don't know. We'll see.
Nothing is out of the water anymore. Like, yeah. Everything is just potential. Unless it includes PlayStation, in which case, fuck you. Nothing happens for you.
I don't know. They got something good happening for them. It's not crossplay related, but Sony's introducing a PlayStation Hits line of games on the PS4. So basically, like, their greatest hits in the past, where they come in a red case and have ugly-ass red border on everything. They're doing that with a new line of games on the PS4 starting June 28th, and there are, I believe, 14 games. They have Bloodborne, Drive Club, Infamous Second Son, Killzone Shadowfall, Little Big Planet 3, Ratchet & Clank, The Last of Us, Uncharted 4, Battlefield 4, Doom, Project Cars, Street Fighter 5, Yakuza Kiwami, Yakuza 0, and Metal Gear Solid 5. All of those will be available for $20 each in an ugly-ass red case.
I mean,
that's my biggest gripe with, like, greatest hits versions or platinum hits is that different colored case that just sticks out like a sore thumb. I hate those.
Just so everybody knows, you waited till it was cheap to buy it.
Yeah, cheap bastard waiting for the $20 version. Like, I think Microsoft did okay with the silver cases, but even now their platinum hits are in normal green cases.
Yeah,
Sony,
they have like a little silver
ones,
band across them, but
those red ones from Sony are just ugly. I hate those red cases, and they're gonna have them for this. Ugh. I can understand
they did, because they know you're not a fan.
Maybe. I can understand having the red banner on the package. It's like PlayStation Hits, cheaper price, whatever else. But just the red plastic cases are just, ugh. Keep them in the blue ones. I like the blue ones. They're pretty.
I don't like blue.
What?
It's funny, but I like green even worse. So, like, I hate green. Green's the worst color in the world.
How can you hate blue?
And then I just alienated, like, the 5 viewers that we have. Because green is the most popular color, favorite color in the world, and I just think it's terrible.
Blue's the best color in the world. I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Fuck green. It's all about blue.
Green is the most popular favorite color. Blue is probably close second or so, but I don't like cool colors, so I don't like blue and green.
It's all about blue. No time knows what's up. Blue rocks.
Show me a case that's yeller, and then I'll be happy. Because that's my favorite color.
did you say yeller?
I did. Thanks for outing me, Joe.
Hey, you're the one who said it. You outed yourself with that. I just called attention to it. Last bit of news I have for the week is that Capcom has stated Devil May Cry 5 is slated for release at the end of March 2019. So at least it's not February 22nd.
At least it's not February. It's still in a pretty crowded window. And it's also going to be around Division 2 time, which sucks because I'm looking forward to Devil May Cry. And I was hoping it would be like January to tide me over.
Well, January is Kingdom Hearts, so that's already.
I'm not gonna play Kingdom Hearts.
and Resident Evil 2.
I'm not gonna play that either because it's probably gonna have those god awful tank controls.
Yeah, but a lot of people are gonna play those too.
That's good for them, but everything should release when I say it should. Haven't we figured this out yet?
Okay, we'll get in touch with Capcom and let them know. I'm sure Capcom would have no problem having one of their titles compete directly against another one of their titles.
It's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
It worked out fine for EA.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What is it? Battlefield, Battlefront, and Titanfall?
It was fine.
All in like a 3-week span, something crazy like that. Yeah, that worked out really fucking well for him. Anyway, that's all the news I got. Anything else from you?
Xbox teamed up with American Girl to release a playset with the Xbox. And people are hateful about it. And I don't understand.
Because hating Microsoft is still the cool thing to do.
Oh.
No matter what.
Okay. Well, I think it's really fucking awesome.
Hey, props to those who like American Girl. It doesn't do anything for me.
I don't normally follow American Girl stuff. I have 3 daughters, obviously. And so, like, the 18-inch dolls, though, we have the cheap ones from Walmart. They're like $25 compared to the hundreds that you'll pay for the American Girl ones. But I was scrolling through Twitter when they were announced, and I just kind of glazed over it initially, and then I scrolled back up when I realized what it was, and number 3 was actually sitting beside me, and she said, "Wait a second," and she like legit crawled over top of me, broke ass leg and all, and is like staring down the monitor, and she says, "Is that an Xbox for the dolls?" And I'm like, "Yeah." She said, "Would it work with mine?" And I thought, "Yeah." And she's like, "I gotta go tell my sister. This is amazing." And like, she goes running through the house and she's like, "Sister," because they don't call each other their names either. They just say sister. I don't know why they started doing that, but that's a thing. And so she's like running through the house. She's like, "Sister, sister." She's like, "We can get Xboxes for our dolls." So I guess that's on the Christmas list this year.
Aren't they like $50 for a set?
They are. There is something really neat though. They're not just like little chunks of plastic. They're actually little projectors, the Xboxes are.
Oh.
So the games have a little, they remind you of the little wheels that go in those flip visor thingies.
Mm-hmm.
But you put it inside the Xbox and it actually projects a little image that looks like, the one looked like it was a American Girl doll playing like a dance, you know, Dance Revolution or Dance Central or something. But like they have little, each one has 10 little scenes and there's 2 of the little discs. So they actually project a little image and everything. Like they went out of their way on this. It's really impressive.
That's nifty.
The little chair actually makes sound and everything. So yeah.
I still don't care, but that's still nifty to do.
Yeah. I understand that it's not for everybody. I'm sad that it's getting so much shit. Because there are kids who are genuinely going to see it and be like, "Oh, that's so cool." It validates, you know, gaming as a hobby in a way for kids who otherwise might not think that it's something they could share. And you know, even though everybody's hung up on the whole, "Oh, it's American Girl" or whatever, they have boy dolls too. My kids even have one of the boy dolls. The Walmart have the knockoff boy dolls. And I actually, you know, have friends in my mom's groups who have sons who have these dolls because boys play with dolls and girls play with games. And that's okay. So it's really cool that, you know, girl or boy doll or girl doll, the game's there, and it's a neat little thing to have. So I'm happy to see it. I thought it was cool they went out of their way to add the little projector feature. I think it's cool.
Cool. Good stuff. I guess. It does nothing for me. I guess I'm just not the target audience. A 38-year-old bald man is not the target audience for toys aimed at younger children.
I think it's important to remember, though, that not everything gaming related is targeted at everybody. And I think that's one of the things that's maybe getting under my skin about there being so much dissent toward it. It's just that, okay, it's not aimed at you. You don't have to be a dick about it, though. You know?
Yeah, they do. Everyone has to be a dick. It's their God-given right to be a dick of people on the internet.
I had some guy tell me the other day that I only had as much gamer score as I do because I play little cartoon indies and not real games like PUBG.
Did he look at your gamer history?
I guess not. And it was funny, though. Like, it's just and the reason I brought that up was because of the whole just people being weird and argumentative about things that aren't marketed toward them. Like, PUBG's an indie. Yeah.
But it's not a cartoon indie.
A lot. So and the weird thing is we were on State of Decay 2 when he said it. I was playing State of Decay 2. And that's an indie. Undead Labs, prior to being bought recently by Microsoft. They were an indie studio. The first State of Decay is an indie. It was in the Xbox Live Arcade. I paid 99 cents for it.
Well, then you bought it on a hell of a sale.
I did. Yeah. It was one of their New Year sales where like a shit ton of stuff gets marked down to a dollar.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, should we jump to reviews and talk about cartoon indies?
Yes, I like to talk about cartoon indies.
Cool. Well, the first cartoon indie to talk about is called Jurassic World Evolution. Developed and published by Frontier Developments, released June 12th on Xbox One, PS4, and Steam for $59.99 because it's a cartoon indie. Place yourself at the heart of the Jurassic franchise and build your own Jurassic world. Bioengineer dinosaurs that think, feel, and react intelligently to the world around them and face threats posed by espionage, breakouts, and devastating tropical storms in an uncertain world where life always finds a way. Cole, tell us about this one.
Holy management simulator.
Hey, you asked for it.
I did, and oddly enough, despite being very business and management simulated, it's not quite as micromanage-y as you would expect. Like, I've played far worse as far as micromanagement goes. Surviving Mars. So this is kind of like micromanagement simulator for beginners. With some hardcore dinosaur porn, minus the actual sex aspect of porn, but like the models for the dinosaurs in this game and the world building and everything, the art direction is so hyper realistic and it is so good. So absolutely good and not at all cartoony. It is based in the same premise as the Jurassic World franchise that we've seen from Jurassic Park and everything. Even to the point that there are some big name celebrities who come back to the series to voice their characters in the game, including Jeff Goldblum, B.D. Wong, and Bryce Dallas Howard.
Oh, nice.
Although, I will say Jeff Goldblum kind of sounds like he's just reading the script for the first time.
He probably is.
He kind of winged it a little, and that's
he
okay.
Just phoned it in.
Yeah, like you're like, oh, that's actually Jeff Goldblum. Okay. He really enjoyed pronouncing the name of the islands. Please don't ask me to pronounce those names. I can't.
Okay.
Chris Pratt, however, is not one of the voices in the game, even though his character is there, which is a little weird because the voice actor, the character model does not look like Chris Pratt. It's very, very close without exactly being him.
Mm.
And it does look more like the voice actor, who is still very similar. It's a really good impersonation. It's just not quite right. But the voice actor doesn't even attempt an impersonation. Like, everybody else is there, and Chris Pratt was very much not on board, which is a shame, because it would have been a little better with him.
Oh, shit. Vertically Impaired has too much money and just donated $10. Damn, Tony. That's twice in a row. Why?
Yeah.
I love you, but why?
Also, thank you.
Thank you very, very much. But why? I'm not that good.
So for the actual gameplay itself, there are 5 islands predominantly that are the campaign for the game. Each island has its own challenge. The size predominantly is the biggest challenge, but some of them are already laid out and have certain buildings, so you can't have like 2 research centers on one island or what have you. So you're kind of stuck trying to build up the park around the necessary research items that you need. And then it kind of just gets into try to earn enough money to keep shit afloat until you can unlock the next island. there's some weird decisions that go on, though, as far as like how much money you can earn and stuff. It all seems very heavily based on the variety and types of dinosaurs that you unearth and manage to successfully hatch. So if you don't have a good variety of dinosaurs, you're not going to have a whole lot of guests, and then they're not going to spend money, and then you're going to struggle and flounder and not unlock any extra islands. It's very heavily based on find dinos, make dinos, get dinos out, don't let dinos die.
Nice.
One of my biggest complaints, though, about the game is that, unlike a lot of simulators, again, like you look at other ones like Surviving Mars or City Skylines or anything like that, anytime where you're trying to, where you have to wait a certain amount of time for research or the development of something or the building of something or just to get enough money to progress ahead, you have the ability to speed up time. Jurassic World doesn't do that. You don't have, there is no time mechanic, and there's no day or night cycle. So you can't fast forward or speed anything up. You're just stuck there waiting. Yeah. And some of the buildings or the research or the expeditions can cost a lot of money. Even the cost of incubating and hatching the dinosaurs can be really expensive, especially if you're going for something, you know, bigger, like a T-Rex or what have you. Like just the time to get enough money to even try to incubate something can be a bit of a drag, and you have no way to speed it up or anything. And this is kind of magnified by the fact that there is a fail rate on incubating, which is realistic and makes sense. It's a perfectly fine mechanic. If it weren't for the fact that you just have to wait forever, because if you have a failure to incubate, or your egg hatches but doesn't survive to maturity and you don't get to release it, the money that dinosaur costed you is gone. And you're talking, some of these dinos can be $700,000 to $1 million.
Good Lord.
And then you just have no choice. If you are hurting on income, and you think, okay, I'm going to put all my money into this one big dino so that I get a boost in visitors and can start generating more income, and then that incubation fails, you're fucked. You're just going to have to sit there and wait until you get the money back again. So that really is my only major complaint. It's just that, good Lord, that's a pain in the ass.
And to be fair, that sounds like something that with enough feedback, they could go in and add some kind of way to speed up time. It doesn't sound like that big of a hurdle to overcome.
And I'm not even going to lie in that there were times where I'd just be like, if you're careful, you can set things up in a way that you know your game is going to be safe. And so I would just, you know, set the controller aside, go make a snack, check YouTube for a few minutes, come back and be, oh, now I've got enough money and I'm okay. This is a little harder to do on some of the later islands where you have issues like storms and stuff that will crop up.
Yeah.
Because the worst thing that can happen is your fence gets destroyed and your dinosaurs go on a rampage and start killing your guests.
Oh, God.
Which is totally a thing that can and will happen.
Yeah, one of my friends has been playing it, and she said that she was having a lot of fun with it, but she would continually just get lawsuits against her for dinosaurs getting out and fucking killing people.
She needs to upgrade to electrified fences.
I'll be sure to let her know.
Yeah.
But,
and it's just that it can be, you know, like I said, just a pain in the ass if things go wrong and you don't have the money to deal with it. No. One thing that I did like that I thought was really neat, though, you have to have, like, rangers and containment units. One is a helicopter for, like, transporting the dinosaurs and stuff. And then, of course, the ranger units are in the little jeeps like you see in the game. You can actually take over and control those manually.
Oh, nice.
So rather than just, like, if you want to be, you know, quick and efficient about it or whatever, you can just tell the AI to do it and just set up like a task list of two or three things for each unit to go do. And they'll take care of it all for you while you just muddle over something else. But if you really want to get down into the action, you can take over and you can drive and you can go and tranquilize the dinosaurs and administer medication to them or, you know, refill planters or even just drive around and take pictures. There are achievements for taking pictures of dinosaurs attacking your visitors. And I spent an obscene amount of time earlier letting Dilophosaurs run around just trying to get pictures of them doing Dilophosaur things.
Oh, you achievement whore.
And I had so much fun.
Well, overall, $60 on this one. What do you think of it?
I do give it a buy it. I really did have a lot of fun. I intend to keep playing it some more because I like these kind of games anyway. And like I said, if the biggest complaint is just that I have to sit down the controller and go do something else for a few minutes till I get money, so be it.
No. I'm not huge into Sim stuff myself, but I might have to give this one a try. Just be between you and my friend Megan just praising it so much, I might have to give it a shot.
One of my favorite things in playing it is that my youngest daughter, number three, she loves dinosaurs in every capacity. So there are dinosaurs all over my house. She has clothes with dinosaurs on them. She talks about dinosaurs all the time. Dinosaurs are her shit. And so she has had an absolute blast when I let her watch because I'm not letting the Dilophosaurs run around kill people.
God.
She absolutely loves to watch. There's this cinematic whenever you incubate an egg and you release it. Once that dinosaur reaches maturity and you let it out, and there's this big cinematic where it steps out of the containment unit for the first time and it roars and makes a big scene.
Roar.
And every time she was just so into it, and she would just sit there and, you know, each animal has its stats of what kind of forest it likes, how much forest it likes, how much water it needs, social and all that. And so she was just sitting there really soaking everything in. Oh, that likes water. This doesn't like water. This doesn't like to have other dinosaurs around it. You know, good luck putting two T-Rexes in a cage. What happens then? You know, so she was just really soaking it all in and enjoying it. If for nothing else, if you've got a kid that loves dinosaurs, they're going to have a blast just watching the cutscenes.
Nice. Anyway, next game to talk about is called Haymrick, developed by Below the Game, published by 1C Company. It released June 19th on Xbox One, PS4, and PC for $19.99. Make words come to life in this action adventure unlike any other. Haymrick blends gameplay with the narrative of its story set in medieval times. Combined with crisp humor and rare visual style, Haymrick's journey is sure to entertain Words the Word. This game is a really, really, really unique twist on an action platformer mixed with like a puzzle platformer. The way the game works is you are Aymeric and you are a writer in this town, medieval town, living with your mom, just kind of struggling to get by. Your friends are, you know, just different villagers. One runs a bar, and out of nowhere, you find this magical book that sucks you into it when you cut your hand. And once you're inside the book, the rest of the story is told on the ground. Like, what is happening and what's supposed to happen in the game is all written out on the ground, and you just walk along the ground and read the story, and then puzzles will come up. Like, there'll be a fire that'll pop up. The story will mention something about a fire, so when you get to the word fire, fire sprouts up from the ground. And your goal is to figure out how to get past that. So you would look back in everything else that you just read and walked over, and you might see something of, like, you know, mentioning mud. And hey, mud could put out a fire, right? So you go and you have to hit the button to pick up mud, but you can't just grab a handful of mud. So you keep reading, and there's something that mentions a bucket. So you pick up a bucket, you go back to mud, you pick up the mud, put it in the bucket, go back to the fire, throw the bucket at it, and the fire goes out, and you proceed on. Or there could be easier ones, like it mentions a fire and something previously mentioned rain, which makes it a lot easier. you'll run into enemies, and you'll have to look for different ways to defend yourself, whether you're picking up a knife or a sword, or whether you pick up a crossbow. And you, of course, if you pick up a crossbow, you got to find arrows as well. It feels very much like Scribblenauts, but the text is already there waiting for you, and you just have to figure out how to progress through the game. There's some boss fights in the game that kind of play out like a chase sequence, puts a fun twist on it. There's standard kind of action platformy, walking through the town, walking through caverns, moving, just basically plot points to get you from being in the book to leaving to going back into the book, since the meat of the gameplay happens inside this magical book. The best part of this game for me is the humor and the cartoony violence to it. Aymeric dies in some incredible ways in this game.
Oh.
Starting from the beginning, there's a mini kind of chase, quick time event sequence where you're sliding down a hill and you have to jump over fires. If you mistime your jump and you hit the fire, you just see like a bloody splatter sliding down. Like, the violence in this game is so cartoonishly over the top that I found myself laughing at these grotesque, horrible deaths. But the visual style, which is all like hand-drawn, pencil drawing look to it, it is just so charming and so funny that these horrible, awful deaths are humorous, and it works really well. It's a really, really well done visual style. The animation is really well done. There's minor voice acting in the game, mostly like just grunts and everything else, but, you know, like, huh, ha, huh. And it's just really well done, cutesy, entertaining. The best thing I could say about this game is that it is just entertaining from start to finish. The downside, you could probably beat the game in about 4 hours. My total play time once I finished the game was just shy of 5 hours, and I know I left it on the title screen and had dinner once. you could probably get it done in 4 to 5 hours if you're pretty good at puzzle games. Some of the puzzles might take you a couple of attempts to figure everything out. There is a lot of trial and error in the game, and just figuring out what you got to do, dying, figuring out, oh, I'm not supposed to do that, let me try a different path. Another negative, and I know you're going to hate this, there's no chapter select.
No, this is my arch nemesis.
Yeah, I beat the game. I played part of it and I realized, hey, I missed this one achievement. I wonder if there's a stage select so I could just go back and select this chapter and retry it. Nope. I hoped maybe if I beat the game, it unlocks a scene select so I could go back. Nope, it didn't. So all of the miscellaneous secret achievements in this game, you either got to follow a guide and make sure that you're paying attention and you get them, or you're going to have to replay the entire game again to get it. On the bright side, there is no speedrun achievement. So I know that'll
that's
make
a little
happy.
Redemptive.
Though I will say, if you were to beat this game and then try speedrunning it, you could probably beat it in maybe an hour and a half. The most of the challenge in this game is going to be figuring it out. And once you figure everything out, you could just pretty much blaze through it if you really wanted. It's not a huge game. That said, $20 on it, I feel it's a little bit on the pricey side. If this was $15, I would give it a wholehearted recommendation. As it stands for $20, it's still a very, very highly recommended try it. It's just the shorter length of the game mixed with the higher price of the game. I can't give it my full support, but if you've got the extra money to spare and you want to get a good laugh out of it, even though, you know, as you get near the end of the game, there will be points where you're like, oh, God damn it, I'm going back in the book again. I just want to see the end of the story. I was really sucked into the story on this one. It was really good. But otherwise, yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's good stuff.
Nice.
All right, next game to talk about is called Yet Another Zombie Defense HD, developed and published by Awesome Game Studio, released June 22nd on Xbox One for $4.99. Top-down zombie shooter with tower defense elements featuring up to 4 players, local and online co-op. Build your base by day, defend it by night, put your skills to the test to stay alive as long as possible. Darkness is coming, how long can you survive? Well, Cole, how long did you survive?
Not long enough. I think I made it at most like 10 or 12 days. But there was an aspect that kind of shook things up when I was playing, and that's that this game has online.
Yeah, it does.
I had decided to allow my game to be open. That way I could test out the online while I was playing. And I had people randomly dropping in, and some were helpful and some were not.
Welcome to today's internet.
Yeah, it is the nature of when you let randoms join you. But it did, you know, affect the gameplay if I was willing to just sit down and play and not have it open, because like I said, I wanted to test out the netcode. But if I had been just playing on my own, I think I would have got a lot farther.
So what do you do in the game?
Most of the people I ran into were jerks. It really is just a zombie defense game. You start off, it looks like a parking lot. It's just a plain gray. There's literally nothing around except for one lamp. Minimalism is pretty prominent here. When you start the game up, you do get to choose between 4 main characters. I think there's one that's a doctor, one that's a SWAT team guy, and then there's the guy or the girl. There's not a lot of effort for backstory here. It's just pick a character. None of them have any special abilities. None of them do anything outrageous. It's just a skin. And then you're dumped in the middle of this just bland gray lot that has the one streetlight, like I mentioned. And during the day, ideally, you want to be able to build up your base. However, the first day, even the first couple of days, you're not really able to do much because you only earn money during the night when you are getting swamped by hordes of zombies. Mm. You do start off with a pistol that has infinite ammo. Thank goodness. And the zombies for the first day or two are fairly weak. They are bullet spongy, unfortunately, but they're not going to take you down, and you can kind of move away from them enough to, you know, take them out without any grand issue. And then you're just going to move on after the night ends. If you survive, then you get to take the money that you've earned from killing zombies. Unfortunately, there's no like, oh, you earn X amount for killing this amount of zombies or anything. It's just sometimes they randomly drop money. So you do have to pick it up, and it can disappear before you get to it.
Oh no.
But yeah, that's a problem. The area you're in is fairly small, at least, so it's not a great issue. It was only when I was in later levels and there were a lot of zombies kind of everywhere, and I was throwing grenades and stuff where I was like having drops on the other side of the map that I couldn't get to before they would disappear. But it is a case of you have to pick it up, and you have to pick it up quickly. Gotcha. Once you do survive, then you're able to go into the shop during the day. The shop is really simple and kind of ugly UI. It just pops up. Different items are in kind of like this scrollable list at the top of the screen. And then there's just a little box with some details about it on the left-hand side. It's very, very minimal. But it'll say, you know, you can buy a chainsaw or a rocket launcher or an assault rifle. And then, of course, once you buy the weapon, you have to buy ammunition for it. Because unlike the pistol, they will run out of ammo. So you have to, you know, buy mines. You can buy barricades and build around your lamppost so that you're building up a base to make it more difficult for the zombies to swarm you. And how you build up what your, you know, little base looks like and everything is entirely up to you. You can buy wooden barricades that, you know, don't take as much of a beating from the zombies, but do help in the beginning. You can buy electric fences eventually. The prices kind of feel a little arbitrary. And they don't always line up with how far you've progressed versus how much you can make, if that makes sense. Like, it's, you can save up and just still not be able to get anything useful. Yeah. which can kind of set you back. It's a little worse too when you realize that during co-op, this is where the randoms joining me was a problem. The money is shared. So you have to really be able to talk to the person that you're playing with. And, you know, work out how you're going to spend your money. Because the dude that jumped in my game, he was buying bases for auto turrets, but not, then we couldn't afford a gun to sit on the turret.
God.
And so there were just turret bases sitting around, and we didn't have barricades or anything. And I'm like, dude, please stop spending our money.
And that's when you kick the player.
Yeah, and there's not an option to do that. Or if they're like, couldn't find it, you're just stuck with whoever comes in and goes. Again, because it is very minimal as far as UI goes. There's just not a lot of options there. There are three game modes. In addition to just trying to survive, there's what they're, you know, cooperatively or alone. There is a deathmatch mode as well, where you're actually trying to kill other players, even though they're human. The zombies are a threat, and they're still there, and they can attack you as well. And it's kind of, it's like a poor man's battle royale.
Everything has battle royale.
I didn't even really get to play it that much because I couldn't find games for it. So unfortunately, they just... It wasn't even really an option.
Yeah, the joys of pre-release gaming.
Yeah, what little I know about it was only because I was able to find some YouTube videos of people on Steam playing it, which was a shame because I would have liked to try that out, at least just to see, like, if I could murderate these people who were jumping into my games and messing me up. All said and done, yeah, it's not pretty. It's not anything that's going to blow your mind. But if you're looking for something kind of co-op to blow a little bit of time in, at a $5 price tag, I do give this a fuck it, why not? I'm always inclined to support games, indie games that are smaller budget, might not be over the top, but at least go make an effort to have multiplayer.
Yeah. And that was $5 and online.
Yeah, $5, I can drag a friend along, we can build up a base and just kind of smash through some zombies. I'm not mad at it at all. the netcode was solid, even with people jumping in and out of my game over, you know, a couple days of playing it. I never had any issues with lag, there was never any stutter. It didn't make the game more difficult for somebody else to be there, other than the fact that they were being dumb and wasting the money.
Nice.
Yeah, so it was an all in all, it was a enjoyable experience. So for $5 with online, I do say fuck it, why not?
Sounds good. Next game to talk about is called Awkward, developed by Snapfinger Click. It released June 5th on Xbox, PS4, and PC for $11.99, coming to the Switch as well. At the end of the 1800s, the government declared a global ban on this legendary card game due to an increase in bar fights, divorces, and family feuds. It was political correctness gone mad. Awkward is the ultimate test on finding out how well friends, couples, and family know each other. First off, that's kind of a joke. I hope people realize that. I don't believe this game existed in the 1800s. But this is an interesting twist on, like, the Jackbox formula, where you are presented with a question with two choices. For example, I'm trying to think of a good one. The one that we ran into the other night was, who would you rather walk in on having sex, your father or your partner's father? Questions like that. And then you have to make a choice of, in depending on the mode that you're playing, in single player, you're supposed to guess what the general public voted on that question. And if you agree with them, you get, you know, it's a, you get points for it. If not, it's, ooh, awkward. There are a bunch of different modes to it, and all of them play a little bit differently. Locally, you could have up to 6 players playing it. Everything is done on one controller, so it's going to be a pass the controller kind of thing. And like, hey, friend, close your eyes while I'm answering this, because, you know, they have team modes where it's like 2-on-2 or 3-on-3, and you have to see how well your teammates work with each other and agree with each other and how well you know each other. Or in like a free-for-all mode, just how well you and whichever player you're matched against for that round, how well you know each other. And it's just coming down to these A or B questions, picking an answer, and then waiting for your teammate or whoever else to answer and hope that they pick the same question or pick the same answer as you. There's also an online element to this, which is a live show, where I did this in single player because I don't have any friends to try out a multiplayer live show. But it comes down to people in your Twitch or Mixer or YouTube chat room answering along with the question and trying to guess what you picked. So, you know, when I said I would rather see my dad having sex with people, and the people online thought that I would rather see my wife's father having sex with people, you know, it turns into pure hilarity and craziness and goofiness. I did have a couple of issues with the game. The first one is that it really, really, really needs to have a party together. Like, you need to have a bunch of people here. There is the single player mode where you're just trying to guess what the general public was saying on there, where it kind of plays kind of like a family feud of, if you agree with the majority or if you're wrong and you don't guess the right one. But it is definitely something meant to be played with more people in public or in the same spot, like a couch co-op, a local party. The online play was fun. I did have a lot of fun with it. The linking the accounts, it felt like every time I fired up the game, I had to relink my Twitch account to the game. And that was a pain in the ass, because I would go into the settings, it would say I need to connect my Twitch, I would hit the thing, and it needs a PIN number, some kind of PIN code that you have to click on the button to get the code, and then it loads up the Edge browser, and then you have to sign in through Twitch, and then you have to agree that the app can access your Twitch account, and then it gives you a PIN, and then you have to go back to the game, and then you have to put the PIN in and hope it links up, and then you have to fire up Twitch separately so that you could start broadcasting on there, and you have to hope that Twitch loads up and it doesn't give you any fucking errors. And then once it's all up and running, you get your stream started, and finally, after 15 minutes of fucking around and everything else, you could finally play the game. It was kind of a pain in the ass.
It did crash the stream, too, because at one point when you had already started the stream up, only to realize that it wasn't connected, and then it crashed it off, so we had to wait for you to...
When it opened up the Edge browser, it killed the Twitch stream, so I had to hope that Twitch loaded back up, but it wouldn't. It kept saying, oh, there was an error, please hold the power button for 10 seconds and reboot your console. So I had to go through all of that crap to reboot the console, and I had to fucking sync it up again after it loaded up. The fact that it doesn't remember your Twitch credentials every time you play is a pain in the ass, and they need to do something to address that, because one of the highlights is playing with other people and having your community watching you play and laughing along with you, playing with you, and it is a pain in the ass to get that going. I appreciate what they did, but the simplicity of Jackbox, of everyone just logging into an app, seemed to work better than just typing in the Twitch chat. And even there were a couple of rounds where people would answer in the chat room and it wouldn't register in the game. And we couldn't figure out why it wouldn't do that. We tried a couple of things, from having everyone answer at the same time. People answered early, people answered late, and, you know, sometimes they would register, sometimes they wouldn't, and it made no rhyme or reason to why.
Yeah, it was just really random. One of the things that kind of got me was just that there were only the two options, and there was never, like, any kind of, it was always just one weird extreme or another.
Yeah.
And then you're sitting there going, well, but what if it's both?
Yeah, there were a couple of those. Like, are you fidgety in bed or do you snore? It's like, I'm fucking both of them. Do I have to pick one? Or like the extremes, were you a jock in high school or were you an uber nerd? It's like, what if you were a kind of a popular nerd? That's what I was. So it was very much one extreme or the other. We did run into a bug a few times as well, where the music would just stop while you were playing. And we couldn't figure that out either, that the music playing and then just out of nowhere it cuts out. It would come back the next round, but it still just couldn't figure out why it did it. But the game is still goofy fun. For $12, if you have friends that will come over and play this with you, or if you have a decent-sized Twitch, Mixer, YouTube community that will sit and watch you play this and play along with you, I think it's definitely worth a try. If you're going to be playing by yourself, it's going to be a harder sell.
Yeah.
But $12 overall, I give it a try. It's a lot of fun. It's funny. The only other thing I couldn't figure out is why the game is rated M.
Yeah, I don't know. None of the questions really seemed that severe. Maybe we're just like, we're desensitized now, Joe.
Maybe. Yeah, I got the achievement for playing 10 complete games. I know I played a couple of other partial games just messing around. I couldn't figure out why the game is rated M. Like, even the one question of, like, it mentioned poop. It's like, it didn't say shit.
Yeah.
It was just poop, and I couldn't figure out why this game has an M rating. Maybe there's just some questions that we didn't run into yet, because there's thousands of questions in the game. So maybe it's just something we didn't run into that got the M rating, because the most risque one I could think of that we ran into was your father having sex. And even that wasn't like, even who's your father
having sex. It was who was going to walk in on you having sex.
Yeah.
So it was just like, eh?
Yeah.
But we're desensitized. We play too many video games.
Maybe. The bloody gore in Haymarket I thought was more M rated than the questions and awkward, so who knows. Next game to talk about is called Atomine, or Atomine, one of those. Developed and published by Broken Arms Game Party. Released June 22nd on Xbox One for $9.99, previously on Steam. Atomine is a twin-stick procedural shooter roguelite set in a virtual world with minimalist design, where the player recounts on the screen the real events of Stuxnet, the first weapon ever created in the form of computer virus. Cole, what the hell is this?
Atomine, I assume that's how you pronounce it, is another beautifully minimal twin stick roguelite shooter. It's twin stick in the absolute truest form. You do not use the face buttons, you do not use the bumpers, you do not use the triggers. It is just the twin sticks.
Nice.
One aims, one shoots. That's it. It's incredibly simple. Anybody can pick it up but it's very, very difficult to master. So the premise of the game is that it's supposed to simulate the events of Stuxnet, which was when a computer virus was first weaponized. Your character in the game is literally just a little cube. There is no bells and whistles. It's incredibly simplistic. It is supposed to mimic and recreate this computer virus scenario. So there's all of the levels, which are procedurally generated, are random layouts of these just very simple, minimal square rooms. Some are more rectangular. Some of them have pillars in them for obstacles. Most of them are just square rooms, though, of different sizes. A lot of, you know, white space and simple lines to kind of indicate circuitry, if you will. Mm-hmm. The enemies, again, most of them are just cubes or rectangles in some form. They are generally black and red in some way to kind of indicate that it's an enemy that you should shoot at. So shoot here. That's pretty much it. Some of them just swarm at you and attack. Others, you know, are damage you by coming in contact with you, whereas others do have some projectiles that you will need to avoid. But it's very low-key, simple, twin-stick. And that's not a negative thing at all, because I found myself constantly wanting to go back and do it one more time. Just one more attempt.
One more round.
Yeah, because when you die, you start all over again. But as you progress through, the more attempts you make, the more upgraded you become as a virus. So you can, it's basically like improving versions. So you start off version 1, you move up to version 2, version 3, version 4.0. You do have power-ups that are available. They don't drop within the realm. Each level has one room that is kind of supposed to be like a secret room, and that it's a little black room off to the side with a blue cube in it. So if you go to that cube, you can choose a module to upgrade or change your abilities somehow so that you have like different fire patterns for your weapons, or you can upgrade and have like a laser beam as opposed to shooting a projectile, or you can have a beam of electric or whatever. So there's different types of power-ups that kind of change the way you progress and play. But I found that most of the power-ups were kind of more hassle than they were worth. They look cool for a run, but they would get me dead way faster. I just was a lot happier with shooting normally. But you can test them out. Like if you go into the room and you apply a module and you realize that maybe it's not going to work for you after all, you can go back into the room and change your modules as many times as you want. So like I would go in and I'd pick a module and I'd come out and realize that it's one of those that causes like instead of you shooting up the middle, it would be one would go left, one would go right. I hate that kind of fire pattern. I hated it in Binding of Isaac and every other roguelike that has it. It's just a pain in the ass. I don't know why it's a thing. And I would immediately go back and get rid of it.
Just let me shoot straight. Pattern.
Yeah, I want the bullets to go where I'm pointing. But you can also gain XP that results in permanent upgrades. So again, the more you try, the more you unlock the different abilities and also the more powerful that they do become for future runs so that you stand a chance of getting further each time. So that's why that just one more, maybe I'll get just something that's going to help me get a little further.
Nice.
If I remember correctly, I think there were 12 levels. I did not make it through them. I did not beat it. It's incredibly difficult, mainly because you have a set number of enemies per level. And once you destroy them all, it opens up what's called a backdoor so that you can progress to the next one. And I have like this weird quirk where I see the number of how many enemies are left. And once it gets low, like, oh, there's only two or three, then I get cocky and do dumb shit.
That'll get you every time.
Yeah. And then the bosses are also just, there are a couple of boss levels where you're just like, yeah, I've made a mistake.
Nice.
But it's difficult to master, but it's fun and it's easy enough to pick up that you just want to go back and keep trying again.
Cool. So $10 on it. What do you think?
I give it a buy it. It's really good. I think that its simplicity is what makes it shine the most.
Nice. Sounds good. I was looking at that one in just another zombie, yet another zombie defense HD. I'm trying to pick which one I should go with since they're both kind of twin sticky games. Which would you recommend between the two?
I would take, well, it depends. If you're wanting to play with friends, you could get yet another zombie defense for yourself and a friend and drag them through it.
True.
But if I were going to pick one for myself personally, I would go with Adamine.
Cool. Sounds good. Final game to talk about tonight is called Pwd, developed and published by Henchman and Goon. It released June 21st on the Switch for $24.99. Traveling through the insides of a mysterious and magical mountain, Boulder and Glow, breathe life into an ancient sleeping world and explore the ruins of a lost civilization with their unique talents and abilities. Only by helping each other can these unlikely adventure companions solve the ancient puzzles that open the secret passageways up the caverns of Mount Fjellheim, or Fjellheim. Why do games have to have such crazy names in them?
fantasy.
True. Though I think it's based on Norwegian theme, so it might be a real mountain name. But who knows? Anyway, our friend Alan Bish covered this one and wrote in a review, and this is what he's got to say. Pwd is a co-op-focused puzzle platform game developed and published on Nintendo Switch by Norwegian indie game studio Henchman and Goon. The player controls two characters, a fallen star named Glow and a small rock named Boulder. Together, they climb a mountain to try and get Glow back into the sky. As they use their unique abilities to overcome obstacles, they breathe life into the rooms by spouting crystal formations and lush vegetation from the ground. Rooms that start barren and empty are gorgeous and vibrant by the time they've been completed. Boulder can pick up blocks and activate switches, while Glow can transport and is lightweight enough to float on water and over bigger gaps. It's impossible to rely on just one, as switching countless times between the two is the key to completion. Solo play is possible, but Pwd was built for co-op play. There are also collectibles to find, including light particles trapped in stone flowers and ancient runes that tell the story of the mountain are to find themselves in. Soundtrack is provided by Austin Winery of Journey, Flow, and Banner Saga fame, and it's much different than his usual output. Leaning into the Norwegian themes, his music is very calm and relaxing. He used the phrase introspective and meditative to describe Pwd's score, and it's very apt. Could only find a few downsides during my playthrough. Pwd suffers from slowdown, choppy visuals, and even frame skipping at times in larger rooms with complex scenery. While never approaching unplayable levels, it was very noticeable in both handheld and dock play. Also, I felt that although this was a great experience, there's simply not enough content here to justify its asking price. I averaged around 6 hours per playthrough, and searching for collectibles didn't add much more time to that. You only gain two new abilities during gameplay, and one is at the very end of the game that makes earlier levels considerably easier. All things considered, Pwd is one of the most beautiful indie games I've played in a long while. Played through it with my 7-year-old, and although there was a little bit of challenge and some moments of frustration, we both loved the experience, and there are a few eShop titles out there more charming than this. Oh, and there's a dedicated button to make Glow and Boulder hold hands, and you just can't beat that.
I'm kind of in love with the sound of this.
Hopefully it comes to some other platforms, because it sounds charming as hell.
I would play it. I just from listening to the hold hand button, I'm down for that.
I love games that have stuff like that. Oh, man. But yeah, that is it for this episode. We wrapped up another long one. It's weird. We go from long one to really short one to another long one. So...
yeah.
The joys of having interviews, I guess. But one more thanks to everyone at Asymmetric for dropping by and chatting with us, and to Chris Taylor for hanging out with that. Thanks to you for coming on here and keeping me company during these. So do you have any final words to end this?
I do not. No.
No? Nothing?
No. Oh, Jurassic World Evolution got an update with new dinosaurs.
It's almost like that happened in the past hour since we talked about the game, and this isn't a whole new day that we recorded.
Yep, but I didn't get to include it in my review. So there it is. That's my final words.
Thank you.